Welcome to the Vaccines Revealed bonus episode, episode 10. I'm your host, Dr. Patrick Gentempo. You know, it's often said that the best is saved for last, and today is no exception. We have some amazing interviews for you today. A lot of people have been very, very interested in the whole issue and controversy around the Gardasil vaccine. Well, we have one of the scientists involved in the development of that vaccine that we interviewed. Tony Bark interviews Dr. Diane Harper. We also have today somebody I have an enormous amount of admiration and respect for, someone who many consider sort of the godmother of the vaccine movement, Barbara Lowe Fisher, who is the founder and the head of the National Vaccine Information Center. I have known Barb for a lot of years. I've been on radio shows with her. I've helped raise money for her organization. And I have to tell you that the wisdom and experience and determination of this person is nothing short of extraordinary and inspiring. You want to see her interview. I have a part four of my interview with Sayer G, and I just love Sayer G, and I love the way that he communicates all of the facts, information, and motivation around the vaccine issue. Also in today's bonus episode, we have Dr. Terry Walls, and you'll want to tune in for her powerful, powerful words around this vaccine issue. In addition, I want to introduce you to the Czech family. The Czech family is a pillar case in the vaccine community. When you see what they faced and the type of legal battle that they were entangled in, it's something that's going to wake you up in a way like maybe nothing else has. And we also interview their attorney, Patricia Finn. So this is a power-packed day of information that's a bonus for you in Vaccines Revealed. Enjoy this episode.
Diane, it's so exciting to meet you in the flesh. I've been talking to you for 4 years now.
At least.
So yes. Actually, the first time I saw your name was I had read the interview that Marcia Yerman did with you in the Huffington Post.
Yes.
And time has lapsed since then. It was an amazing interview. Amazing interview. I was blown away. I don't want to repeat the interview, but I want you to start off by telling me why you were being interviewed in the first place. What is your role to the Gardasil vaccine? What is your role with Merck? What was your role, and what has happened since then?
My role in the whole story of the HPV vaccines is not where I was at the bench. I did not develop the VLP. I did not torture mice. Where I came into the picture was once they had a potential vaccine that they thought would work in human beings, I was then asked to be a part of the international group that worked with both Merck and with GSK to help design the clinical trials in humans that would show what are the appropriate endpoints that we need to look for, and how do we need to look for them, how often do we need to screen, and how many years do we need to follow women in order to understand whether or not these vaccines would have any efficacy.
Mm-hmm. What were the endpoints that you had recommended to look at, and has that been done?
So we needed to have disease endpoints, and we needed to make sure that women were examined. So unlike most pediatric vaccine trials where they could give the vaccine and then just draw blood to check for an antibody response, in this particular vaccine, we had to know that it was actually changing the disease manifestation. So what we did is say that we have to measure the HPV, so we have to know which HPV type is being detected, and then we have to know, are there abnormal pap smears that are happening, and if there are abnormal pap smears, what is the level of histologic or tissue disease that we see? And in the course of the trial, if anyone develops cancer, that would be a very important endpoint. But the trial wasn't designed to detect whether the vaccines would ever prevent against cancer, because we know that cancer is a rare event in the long-term progression of this HPV disease process.
So what you're saying is that the design was never meant to look at, was it preventing cervical cancer? It was just histological changes related to HPV. But clearly, the way that vaccine is marketed, it's marketed, everyone thinks that this is going to prevent cervical cancer.
So the question is, why did the companies not use cervical cancer as the endpoint? The companies knew it would be very expensive for them to take the trials out long enough to be able to capture enough cancer endpoints, and one would also argue that it would be unethical to let a woman develop cancer in a trial when we can prevent it so well with pap smear detection. So that they talked with the FDA and they agreed on what is called a surrogate endpoint. And the FDA agreed with the companies that if they could prove that the vaccines prevented the development of CIN3, that they would allow the label to say that these can prevent cancer. So it was a negotiated agreement with the FDA up front about what endpoints had to be demonstrated by the trials in order for the FDA to allow them to create a label to then advertise to the public.
And there were enough women in the placebo group that developed CIN3 relative to the group that received the vaccine that they felt it was enough of a claim for them to make?
Absolutely. Both Gardasil and Cervarix showed that they had very close to 100% efficacy in the vaccine arm, and that indeed CIN3 lesions developed in the placebo arm that were specifically caused by 16 and 18, which is the targeted HPV types within the vaccine.
So out of curiosity, were there HPV lesions that were not caused by 16 and 18 in the group that received the vaccine?
In the Gardasil trial, yes, there were. There were several. And if you looked at what is the protection against CIN3 due to any type of HPV, even though we know it's not in the vaccine, you see that for Gardasil, that protection is around 40%. You see that for Cervarix, even though it only has two types in the actual vaccine, that protection was 93%. So it shows that Cervarix has much more protection against HPV types that aren't even in the vaccine than does Gardasil.
That's interesting. Wow, you don't read that at all anywhere.
You don't see that difference advertised, because Merck was the first to market and they were a year and a half ahead of GSK. It truly is the marketing principle that won, which is whoever gets to market first gets over 90% of the market share, and then people are anchored in what it is they purchase, what it is they think about, and it's very hard for them to change to something else. If you look at the way they're designed, so both Gardasil and Cervarix have HPV 16 and 18 VLPs in them. So they are specifically designed to protect against 16 and 18. And the efficacy trials showed that for both of these vaccines, they were nearly 100% effective at preventing CIN3 caused by 16 and 18. They are equal. But now, if you go back and say, yeah, but in the Gardasil trial, I had women who were vaccinated with all three doses and who had a CIN3 lesion at the end of the trial. What's going on? Well, that CIN3 lesion was caused by HPV 52. Okay, it's caused by a different type of HPV. So we said, let's look at the data differently. Let's look at the data and say, let's take this endpoint of CIN3 and say, we don't care whether 16 causes it or 18 or 52 or 31 or any of those numbers. We're going to take any CIN3, regardless of which type it is, and see how effective are these vaccines. And what we saw is that with Gardasil, it could prevent against about 40% of the whole group of CIN3s. Okay, so even if you got Gardasil, you could still get 60% of the CIN3s. If we looked at the Cervarix data, what you saw is that it protected against 93% of all CIN3s. 93%. That's almost twice the coverage that you get. So it is much more valuable for its ability to protect against CIN3 lesions. But we don't hear about that.
Can you explain to me what you mean by CIN3?
So if you look at the cervix as tissue, there's five levels of abnormalities a cervix can have. One is normal, which isn't really abnormal, but it's normal. The other one is cancer at the other end. That's very bad. Between normal and cancer, there are three levels of abnormality. We call that CIN1, CIN2, and CIN3. CIN3 is as close to cancer as you can get without being cancer, and still 100% treatable and 100% curable. The CIN1 we consider just an infection. and that it will probably go away with no other problem. So when we look at these trials, we're really interested in the CIN3 outcome. CIN2 is a little different because CIN2, we don't really know which side it leans to. We don't know which way it swings. So we're thinking now that in the United States that we're going to treat it as a precancer. So you will also see reported CIN2/3 as an outcome. But CIN3 is really the one that we want to care about.
And do you know how long the protection from either of the vaccines last? I mean, so the study was, what, 18 months? Because it was fast-tracked, and I know it wasn't many years, but how long was it, and how long do we have evidence for that the antibodies last, that there's protection from either of those vaccinations?
Both Merck and GSK initially designed their clinical trials to follow women for 4 years, so that you would have an opportunity to develop CIN3 for most of the women if they were going to develop a CIN3. Merck was the first one to do their trial, and what they found is that within 18 months of enrollment, they had enough people in the placebo arm who'd already developed a CIN3 that they could show statistical significance to say that Gardasil was protective. They took that data at 18 months to the FDA. Now, the FDA started to make their decisions on it and said, you need to give us follow-up data. So they continued the study, and the study went for a little more than 3 years, at which point they concluded it, stopped it, and fully reported the data to the FDA. But in that meantime, the FDA had already made the fast-track decision that this vaccine was excellent and that it would have FDA approval. Merck used the FDA approval as the reason for them stopping the trial. They said that it was unethical to continue a trial where women were randomized to receive placebo and real thing when the real thing worked. Now, of course, GSK was doing their trial in Cervarix at the same time. And it wasn't unethical for the trials to continue. You just needed to inform women that there was a vaccine that had been FDA approved, and if they wished to withdraw, they could. But the fact of absolutely stopping the trial without giving women an opportunity to continue in the trial was the decision that was made at the corporate level.
And do we know how long the antibodies last? Like, how long is the protection? 3 years? Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? You hear it's for life.
So, interestingly, in this whole process of getting a vaccine approved, there is a phase process. There is phase one happens with only about eight human beings, and that's to make sure that it's not going to kill people. It's usually high risk. It's phase one. You make sure that it's not going to cause any harm. And then you move into a phase two trial, which is what we call proof of principle, or can we really see an outcome and is it not going to cause harm? That's are usually a smaller numbers. Those are usually somewhere in the hundreds, 200s, 300s of people, depending on numbers. And then you move to the phase three trial if the phase two trial works. And the phase three trial is usually in tens, thousands of women. And the phase three trial has to be big and has to be robust in being able to show efficacy. The phase three trial is what the FDA uses to make their assessment about whether the vaccine works or not. The phase two trials is what gives you a lot of information, and that's where we have our duration of efficacy. For Gardasil, the phase two trial lasted for 5 years and then was abruptly stopped. And so we know that in that 5-year time frame, that those hundreds of women, not thousands, but hundreds of women, continued to show protection against HPV 16 and 18. So we can say very firmly and solidly that Gardasil lasts at least 5 years. There have been no publications on any further efficacy beyond that. Merck has presented several abstracts at conferences, but they have never published any data. And those of us in the science world know that if it's not published, it's not real. So we know that abstracted information is often inaccurate. It's often an early report. It's often something that may change when the full spectrum of data are reported Or when you have reviewers asking questions about the way in which the data are being reported. So what we can say about Gardasil is that for sure it's going to last at least 5 years. We have these abstracts that have been reported showing it lasts for 6 years. And beyond that, we don't know. We just don't know. It's unknown. The information is out there. The CDC will tell you we have no evidence that it's not effective. And I would counter that we have no evidence that it is effective. So we really need to just be clear about where we're basing our perspectives. With CervarX, again, it's the phase 2 trial with CervarX. And for CervarX, the data was followed for 9.4 years. 8.4 years is published. So if we're going to use that same metric, then we have to say that CervarX lasts for at least 8.4 years. It shows it has very high antibody titers and has done very well over that period of time. I think an important piece of information to know is that for CervarX, the National Cancer Institute is using that vaccine in their trial in Costa Rica. And what they have found is that they have the same level of efficacy if you only get 2 doses and the same level of efficacy if you only get 1 dose. So the cost of vaccinating people would be a third if you would go to CervarX for the 1 single dose. And that it, in the National Cancer Institute trials, the NCI trials, that again, it lasts at least for 4 years. Who knows how much longer?
Relative to what you know and what you've just told me, compared to what we hear in the media, it seems like there's a disconnect. And so what is your perception of what's being told in the to the public versus what's reality?
So the public needs a simple message. But unfortunately, that simple message was created by a for-profit company. And the simple message was, at the time it came out, get Gardasil and your daughter will be one less, meaning one less cervical cancer victim. Well, in reality, she was never going to be a cervical cancer victim if she had gone on with her pap smears. So the concept of using fear to sell vaccines was prominent and knew that it could get a reaction from the public about, I want to protect my daughter, I want to be a good parent. Now, what was not ever said anywhere was how long the vaccine would last. No one said there may be an issue with you may need booster shots later or it may only last for a certain amount of time. It was completely unspoken. So when people received the vaccine, they thought they were getting something that would last them their entire life. And truly, there were many misconceptions. There were misconceptions that this was a vaccine to cure all cancers. And that is a total misperception. This has nothing to do with all cancers. This has to do with very specific HPV 16-18 related cervical cancers. The other mistake that people took away from this message was, I never have to have another pap smear again because I'm not going to ever have anything wrong with my cervix if I get this vaccine. Well, that's wrong. That is very wrong. And in fact, I think that has hurt women's health more than any other health message has ever happened. We have now the first study published from the UK, from the UK National HPV Immunization Program, that shows us that of women of screening age right now who were vaccinated at the time when the vaccine programs were happening, that of those who received vaccines and are now 21 years and older of screening age, that only 26% of those women went to get their pap smears done. 26%. That is very, very low. We need to have screening rates above 80%, or women are not going to have anything that's wrong detected. Now, the second telling point from that study was that of those women who were vaccinated and did go get screened, 14 to 15% of them had abnormal screens. So you still get abnormal pap smears after vaccination. And we know that from the studies, but that was never publicly acknowledged or publicly stated. The message that you heard was get your HPV vaccine. It was not get your HPV vaccine and make sure you continue your pap screening.
Now, there, I have read some cases of girls who've received the vaccine who actually went on to develop cervical cancer and precancerous lesions. I think in Norway there was a post-surveillance study that was published. Do you know anything about this? And the second part of this is that I've been told that Merck's position on this is that if you are HPV naive, when you receive the vaccine, that may potentiate the HPV strain itself. Do you know, can you speak to this at all?
I don't know the exact study. What I can offer is that if you already are infected with HPV 16 or 18 before you get Gardasil, but you don't have any detectable 16 or 18 on your pap smears, and you get the Gardasil, that 16 or 18 can still develop in the normal course and go into a CIN lesion. The vaccine will not prevent that from happening. It won't speed it up either, and it won't make it worse, but it's immaterial. It doesn't matter that you got the vaccine when you already had the infection. So what that says is that you could have a 16 or 18 infection, get Gardasil, and then go on and develop a CIN3 or potentially even a cancer if you weren't detected, because that vaccine wasn't given at a time when it could prevent that.
Okay. Adverse events. I want to talk to you about the adverse events because I want to talk about the placebo. There's been a lot written about the placebo used in the phase 2 and 3 trials. Phase 1, I understand, was saline injection. But phase 2 and 3 was the aluminum adjuvant, and it has been, well, I've seen research on this aluminum adjuvant specifically, showing that there's a lot of potential for neurotoxicity and adverse neurological events, as well as adverse autoimmune events. So I'm wondering, was this known at the time the vaccine was being created? Were the other researchers aware of this? What is the thinking now in terms of, what's your opinion now that you're no longer involved and we see these studies coming to light?
So again, let's go back to what the FDA and Merck agreed upon and negotiated at the time that they were having their discussions about what would the FDA give them for a label and whether or not they would say it was safe and efficacious. And what Merck said is that we know that no antigen, meaning the material that's actually directed to the disease you're interested in, that no antigen is ever going to last long enough to really prevent disease. So we always have to have this adjuvant or this helper that allows that antigen to stay around longer so that the body can continue to make antibody responses to it and continue to be able to fight off new disease. If you didn't have that adjuvant, then you would never have efficacy. So the FDA agreed that the comparison groups would be the antigens plus adjuvant versus the adjuvant alone. And that was to see whether these antigen particles would actually create an antibody response to move forward. So in the negotiation process, the safety of the adjuvant was not a consideration. There's lots of information that's coming out now, worried about aluminum with dementia, worried about aluminum toxicities, and I think that it is incredibly important that we continue to fund science to understand what are these long-term events. There isn't an adverse event that happens in every single person that gets it, so it's not something common. But it is something that is happening in several people, and understanding what are the scientific linkages and what are the scientific reasons for that is important and needs to be studied. Merck was able to use this proprietary aluminum adjuvant because they had used it in other vaccines. And they had had FDA approval for that aluminum adjuvant, which had been used in many of their other pediatric vaccines, to be used in this vaccine.
Again, I'd love your opinion on this. There is a lot of information coming forward. A lot of families are saying that their daughters have been seriously damaged, permanently damaged, in some cases death, from the vaccine itself. And many people in the industry say that these sudden deaths and these weird autoimmune neurological responses are coincidences. And I'm curious what you think about that.
So I am a physician, and I take care of people. I am also a researcher and do public health research. There is a difference between public health, what is good for the majority of people, versus what I as a physician am going to counsel or guide an individual person in their particular health choices. And I think it's necessary for us to make those two distinctions, is what hat are you wearing at this time? If I wear my public health hat, the World Health Organization, as well as the CDC, has classified adverse events into many categories. But there's one category called very rare, and very rare means it happens less than 1 in 10,000. If it happens at a rate of less than 1 in 10,000, they can't prove it and they can't disprove it. So it is so rare from a public health standpoint, it is so rare that it's inconsequential. 1 in 10,000 does sound rare, maybe, but if you multiply that by hundreds of millions of women, you may get a larger number of people who have real problems with having had the vaccine. It's in a very gray zone. And if a woman or a young girl has a reaction and it's happened after Gardasil, you have to take care of the woman. You have to, in my opinion, as a physician, you have to take care of each woman individually, or again, girl, and you have to provide the appropriate counseling, which is you must continue Pap screening. And if you would like to consider protection against HPV, we have two possible vaccines you could choose from. Again, it's something additional. There are reports of very rare side effects that may happen. Pap smears are uncomfortable, but they don't have side effects. It is incredibly important for us as physicians to make sure that a mother and a daughter, or if it's a young woman, is appropriately educated that she has to continue Pap screening. Before she even gets the shot, you have to say to her, you have to come back for cervical cancer screening and when you're 21 years. And if you want the vaccine, you can. I tell my patients it's like socks and shoes. Okay, you're going to protect your feet if you're wearing shoes, but you may protect your feet more if you wear socks and shoes. If you don't wear socks, you may get blisters, and that's a bad effect. If you only wear socks, you may get bad things happen to your feet because you don't have your shoes on. So Pap smears are your shoes. You have to have your shoes. And whether or not you want HPV vaccines is whether or not you want to wear socks.
Right, but if we're talking about 1 in 10,000, that's not extremely rare. You know, what's the rate of American women getting cervical cancer? Is it less than 1 in 10,000 or more than 1 in 10,000?
The incidence rate in the United States of women developing cervical cancer who have been through a Pap smear screening program right now, on average, is 7 per 100,000 women. So it's smaller than the 1 in 10,000.
Right. And so if, for conversational purposes, if we could say that these reactions, these very serious adverse reactions are 1 in 10,000, the risk of getting cervical cancer is much lower than that. How can we, what's the risk-benefit ratio of this vaccine? I mean, you're comparing it to socks, which, you know, to me may or may not be a fair comparison. I mean, socks prevent blisters. We don't know that the vaccine will really prevent anything for that individual. We do know that the risk, we think the risk, if you look at the reporting, for an adverse event could be a greater risk than their risk of actually getting cervical cancer if they didn't get the vaccine. So, you know, that's what I'm trying to figure out, the risk-benefit ratio here.
That is why it's very important for a physician to have an individual conversation with each woman. That is an individual decision that each woman needs to make. And she needs to understand what is her risk tolerance. From your question, your risk tolerance is that is too high and you would not take it. And many of my patients say that. Many of my patients say, I'll take it. I want the vaccine. I want the protection. I'm not worried about it. It's, you know, do you play the lottery or don't you play the lottery? You know, it's the opposite. If you win the lottery, you're happy. If you, you know, you win the adverse event lottery, you're not happy. That's a bad thing to happen. I think that we have to go back to the construct of the way the United States was put together, which is that businesses are in business to make money. And they're in business to sell their product. And they will sell their product to people for higher prices if they can get those prices so that they can sell their product to people who don't have as much money for lesser prices. So that in the end, they make money. They're a for-profit company. They are beholden to their shareholders. They don't have a physician-patient relationship. They don't have a relationship with WHO or CDC. They are responsible to their shareholders. On the other hand, we have to remember that companies have been very successful with creating infant vaccines, which have saved many children's lives, especially in developing countries. They've been exported from developed countries into developing countries, mostly through philanthropic organizations, to be able to keep these kids alive so we can give them life expanse. So the concept of a vaccine is a good concept in general, but what links it is that the company is there to make money, and they have to sell it to industrialized countries in order to be able to subsidize the lower price that they provide it for in developing countries. Now, that could be viewed good or that could be viewed bad, but the point is that it is a for-profit company that is responsible to their shareholders, and their job is to sell as much vaccine as they can for the biggest price they can get. This is why the discussion about HPV vaccines is not a simple discussion. It's not a discussion of, oh, here, you're 11 years old, you need a shot in your arm. It is a discussion that needs to involve, it needs to be physician to individual, it needs to be one-on-one, it needs to be asking the patient or the patient's mother, if the patient is too young to participate in the decision, about what their risk threshold is, what they value. If that is too high, that is obviously too high for you. And as your physician, if I were your physician, I would say, I respect that, Tony. That is your decision. And you understand that you can get cervical cancer prevention from Pap screening, and that you must continue to do. If I had other patients that have come in and have said, you know, that risk factor doesn't worry me at all, I am okay with that, and I want the extra protection, I may never get an HPV infection in my life, or my HPV infection may go away all by itself, but I want that extra reassurance, then that person has made an individual decision that that risk isn't so much for them. And I respect that as a physician, that they want it. That's I've told them, we've been able to discuss it, and they're okay with that. Again, I will tell them, does not replace your Pap smear. You still have to come in for your cervical cancer screening. That is incredibly important.
So that's not the conversation happening in the country. The conversation that is happening is what you had said initially at the start of this, which is you're 11, you need your Gardasil vaccine. That's the conversation that's happening in doctors' offices today.
That conversation makes me very sad because usually it's the pediatricians who are doing the vaccination, and the pediatricians are not seeing the disease of CIN3 or the disease of abnormal pap smears that young women then have to go through colposcopy, go through biopsies, go through worry, go through screening every 6 months to see whether they are, quote unquote, clearing the virus. That is very sad for me to see that is the way in which this is being rolled out in the United States. as I have said earlier, we now have firm evidence. It's not just a gut feeling, but we now have firm evidence that women who have been screened, both in the Australian screening program and in the UK screening program, that those in both of those countries where HPV vaccination has been highly pushed in school-based programs, that the percentage of young women who show up for screening is lower than 50%. And of those who are actually vaccinated, it's even lower than that. And that is not acceptable for women's health.
And you said that those that have been vaccinated still had a 15% rate of abnormal pap smears.
That's correct. So, and we know that from the studies. We know that both Gardasil and Cervarix will reduce the abnormal pap smears by about 20%. Okay, so that means there's a significant portion of abnormal pap smears that are still happening. And that is important because those women will still have abnormal pap smears. One of the worst messages that could come forward from this vaccination messaging without saying pap smears are there is that those women who get vaccinated and get screened and say, I still had an abnormal pap smear. Who's telling me the truth? And that's when the trust in the public health system or the trust between the patient and their physician starts to fall apart.
So there's studies, there's post-surveillance studies looking at women or girls who received the vaccine to see how many come in for follow-up pap smears for screening, how many partake in the screening program, and how many of those that do partake in the screening program are positive with abnormal pap smears. So the studies exist in the UK and in Australia. Do we have a study here in the United States?
The United States does not have a vaccine registry. They don't have any colposcopy registries. We don't have any registry in which we can look at large numbers of women to determine what is the follow-up of these women over time. The places that are most likely to be able to provide us with this answer are places like Kaiser or places that are very large HMOs that have a population who stayed with them. But I think what we've also seen in health economic studies in the United States is that most people are with their provider for about 3 years before their health insurance changes, and then they're forced to go to a different provider. And so being able to link that data long term just is not the way the United States databases are set up. So we will have this kind of information in the United States, but we'll have it in small groups. We'll have it in groups of maybe 100, 200, maybe 1,000, depending on who's going to look at the study. But we will never have the large numbers that they have in the UK and in Australia that have very early and very clearly shown us that women are choosing not to get pap smears, whether they're vaccinated or not. This whole message has made them not afraid of any kind of cancer or not wanting to participate in something that's preventive and good for their health, to look at it on the positive side. And that, as you've said, the women who do get vaccinated and who do present to screening continue to have abnormal PAPs. So we worry about all of those who aren't coming in for screening and what are their abnormal PAPs and what kind of lesions are they developing.
The time Merck presented the initial studies to the FDA, it was said that there was no HPV DNA in the vaccine. A few years ago, HPV DNA was in fact proven to be present in every vaccine, every lot of vaccine studied. And Merck then changed their verbiage. My question to you as a researcher who understands DNA and understands things that trigger cancers, are you concerned about HPV DNA existing in the vaccine, knowing that it's being injected into young girls and boys?
Would I be concerned about that as a source of HPV infection for, say, head and neck cancer or, say, another kind of cancer? And the answer is probably not, because the way HPV has to infect is that it has to be a skin-to-skin contact. It's not spread through the blood or through lymphatics to be infectious. So probably as a means of infection, that would be inadvertently giving you the infection it was trying to prevent, I'm probably not so concerned. But there's the whole other side of it about what are good manufacturing processes and what kinds of particulate matter, if that's DNA or if it's left over from the E. coli that it is actually manufactured in, what kind of damage or what kind of effect do those particulates have on the body that's completely separate from the vaccine itself? And I think that that's an area of vaccinology and that's an area of study that we haven't looked at very closely.
Do we know that injecting HPV DNA in the bloodstream directly is safe? I mean, how, where is evidence that that... I understand how in natural environment HPV is skin-to-skin. I understand that. But do we have any evidence to show that injecting HPV DNA into somebody's bloodstream is safe?
No.
That's an honest answer. It's the truth.
It's the truth.
Did you leave Merck? I mean, I was under the impression that you kind of left Merck because you did not like the way they were marketing the vaccine. Is that true?
I never have worked for Merck. I have always been an independent scientist. When I was doing my trials and when I was asked to help them design the clinical trials, I was a professor at Dartmouth Medical School, and did some, we were a clinical site and did some of the trials in New Hampshire with the population in New Hampshire and around the Dartmouth campus. I have always been an author on the papers that have come out from Merck. I have looked at the data and have been very critical of the papers that we have put out. I have had multiple conversations with what does this mean and what does this not mean. I think that when you look at the number of papers that are in the Lancet family of journals about HPV vaccines, you'll see that the Lancet has often asked me to provide commentaries about what do the vaccines mean and how do you interpret those results. So that has to provide some weight that I'm an independent scientist and that I am objective and that I will look at things from multiple perspectives and not just a single perspective.
In terms of boys, this vaccine has been rolled out for boys now at quite a young age. What is that based on? Were there decent studies that showed it protects? I mean, were there surrogate endpoints for head and neck and oral cancers? I'm assuming this is, or rectal cancers? I mean, is this why we're pushing this on boys?
Again, Merck goes to the FDA and they say, we would like to have this and show that we can prevent anal cancer. We are not going to wait long enough for anal cancer to be there. So we would like to use the anal intraepithelial neoplasia, AIN, grade 3, similar to the CIN3, as our surrogate endpoint. Now, the time it takes for young boys to get an AIN3 lesion can be very long and very rare, except in the men who have sex with men subgroup. So they're going to restrict the data to the MSM subgroup. And they're going to measure HPV, is it present or absent in the anus, and they're going to do biopsies, and they're going to check to see is there actual disease that's developing. The trial in men with AIN as the outcome was 2.9 years, and it showed that it was efficacious and that it did prevent the AIN3 lesions. It prevented AIN1 most often because that was the most common one, and that's where they got statistical significance. And it prevented HPV infection. They did a similar study in heterosexual men that lasted a little bit longer with only HPV swabs of the anus as the endpoint. They didn't look for disease endpoint. And they could show that it did prevent HPV in that. So because they had this agreement with the FDA that they could use the surrogate AIN endpoint, they were able to make the claim that they could prevent anal cancer. Now, the question is that it's not a very long study, and that if you actually looked at how powerful was the antibody response generated in boys or young men compared to girls of the same age, you saw that boys or young men lost all detectable antibody titers to HPV 18, HPV 6, and HPV 11 about 2 or 3 years earlier than girls lost them. So it might lead you to believe that the protection in boys is not going to be as long as it is in girls. We don't know that. We don't know what long-term is going to be, and we don't know what long-term protection will be.
So that's a little confusing because it, 2 years shorter than the girls, but the girls we've only shown a few years out anyway, and you know, saying we don't really have the endpoint for girls, so I'm not sure how we can say it's 2 years shorter than the girls if we don't have the endpoint for the girls. So that's very confusing for me. But in that study, I know that in some of the studies, the FDA didn't approve it. So the study for Gardasil for older women,
right.
The death rate was so high. There were so many adverse events that they did not approve it for an older group of women.
My understanding on the older women was that the efficacy was not as great in older women as it was in younger women, but there was still efficacy. There was a similar efficacy in what we call HPV-naive women, or women who did not have 16 or 18, as there was in younger women. But the reason the FDA, to my understanding, did not approve it was because they felt that most women, by the time they were 25 to 45, which was the age range of the older women study, that most of those women would have already had the HPV virus anyway, so giving them a vaccine to prevent it didn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. The ability to get FDA approval didn't rest on efficacy or on safety, but more on that the public health message wanted to be, you have to give this vaccine to young women before they're exposed to HPV.
Okay, so it's based more on the message that they wanted to give.
Now, I will tell you, as a physician, again, going back to this one-on-one hat, person with person, we just heard on the NPR news station last night that there are record numbers of women in their 40s and 50s who are divorcing and who are deciding to enter into new relationships. And these women are just as susceptible as our young teenage girls are to HPV infections. And those HPV infections have the same natural history. It's not any different than our younger women. And so you have to look at these older women who are now on the dating scene and are being exposed to possible infections to say you still have to have your pap smears, you have to get sexually transmitted infection screening. It's not something you necessarily have been used to doing, but you have to do it now because you're at risk. And we have to take care of your health.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't know many women who don't go for their pap smear. So, and again, I'm not, you know, I have my own patient population, so that's not a new message that most of the people I know need to hear, but it's good to enforce it because, as you say, if the younger generation is now getting the vaccine and assuming they don't need the pap smear and they become the older generation, they will not get the pap smear. But my understanding, when I was a med student, which was a while ago, that at any one time, if you tested the adult population, about 40% of adults would test positive for HPV, and that most people clear it. And I actually was taught many years ago, about 20 years ago, by some OB-GYNs from Eastern Europe, that if we have abnormal pap smears, we actually put our patients on a regimen, and some of the things in the regimen are folic acid, mm-hmm. and some other immune stimulators, zinc and selenium, and beta-carotene or vitamin A, and bring them back, and we always had great results. And so it was never, you know, I was never taught to believe as a med student or a resident that HPV was a death sentence and that these patients were going to go on to get cervical cancer. And suddenly that message has been really flipped around. If you talk to young doctors, they're, you know, they are all about pushing this vaccine that if you have HPV, you're going to get cervical cancer. What do you think about this?
It is very important to remember the natural history of HPV, which is now very clearly shown that 70% of HPV infections go away all by themselves within the first year, and 90% of HPV infections go away all by themselves within 2 years. Only 5% of women who keep an HPV infection, whose HPV infection is persistent, whose body doesn't naturally clear it, only 5% of those women go on to develop this CIN3. And then, if you take it a step further and say, of all the women with CIN3, how many of them actually get cancer? And it's not all of them. What we see is if you have CIN3, only 1 in 5, only 20% within that first 5 years will get cervical cancer.
Can you recap the study that was done in Australia and the UK for me?
So I'm going to start with the study done in the UK. The UK study is a follow-up of young girls who were vaccinated in their national immunization program. So large numbers throughout the country who are vaccinated that they're now following to the age of where they should be screened. So that's the cervical cancer screening. In some countries, it's known as the Pap test. And they have looked at how many of these girls are coming back for screening and what the results of their screening is. The regular screening rate in the UK, in the United States, in developed countries, is usually 80% or higher. The US has a goal that we're going to reach 93% of our women. And that's what we want to be able to get and reach out to all women to participate in the screening program. In the UK study, of the women who had been vaccinated, only 26% of those women came back in for screening. Of the women who were screened, 14 to 15% of them had an abnormal screen. 26% coming in for screening is very, very low. If you look at that study and look overall, regardless of whether they got HPV vaccine or not, only 46% of those young women came in for screening. So that's even the women who don't have the protection of the vaccine, which is very, very much lower than what the traditional pap smear screening rates are. So it's of great concern to public health officials about what is happening to women who are being vaccinated and not presenting for screening. The Australian study has not yet been published, but it was presented in abstract form, and it showed the exact same data. It showed that following this cohort of young girls who'd been vaccinated in Australia to their age of screening, where they're now of screening age, 20 to 24 years old, that only 46% of them, regardless of whether they got vaccinated or not, came in for screening. And those who got vaccinated had lower screening rates. So again, we've seen this now in two different countries in very large cohorts, and I think we need to pay attention.
So it's as though the vaccine and the whole marketing campaign around the vaccine has reduced good behavior.
That's right. And that is going to hurt women in the long run.
It'll put them at higher risk for missed cancers.
That's correct.
We start to see that the system has inherent cracks in it that lead to fraud, lead to misrepresentation. And it's one thing when it becomes like a business product, you know, that somebody buys. But we're talking about human lives here. And not only that, we're talking about lives of adolescents or young people who aren't in a position really to make the choices themselves yet. And that, to me, is horrific.
Absolutely. We're in a position today where now non-compliance or non-vaccinators, because, you know, quite frankly, you and I may be labeled an anti-vaxxer when actually I am pro-vaccine science and safety, pro-immunity, but there's just no science to support that right now. So, of course, that's the reality, is that we really want to engage a dialogue. We want the science to shed light on what's really happening. But we're at a point in history now where non-compliance is equated to a violent act towards others in society. In fact, when it comes to the live vaccines that are still on the schedule, like MMR, the children that are being vaccinated with those are actually now shedding the vaccine viruses to those who don't vaccinate. So the threat is actually opposite from the way that it's portrayed.
Right, right. It could, because now, if I'm somebody who is, you know, and again, I love the term non-vaxxer versus anti-vaxxer, right? Exactly. It's a matter of saying truth is a value, and freedom of choice as a value, you know, that's really what we're talking about here. But it's almost like you say, like the non-vaxxers are, oh, you're a threat because of the herd, or yes, the, you know, yes, you're adversely affecting the herd.
Yes.
But the reality is, I want the choice that I don't want my kids exposed to this, but now through a shedding effect, as you described, to a kid who has been vaccinated, my kids might be exposed anyway.
Well, you can always default to the age-old, like, obvious common sense fact that if your vaccines, right, work so well, why do you care if my children don't vaccinate?
Right.
It's a subconscious admittance that they do have deep uncertainties whether they do work.
Right.
So that's why the whole concept of herd immunity is used, is to kind of distract from the reality that truly anyone who does believe vaccines are safe and effective, well, guess what? Your child is now super immunized. In fact, my kid could be like totally infected and they should be able to just hang out and play and you shouldn't be worried. But that doesn't happen because they do actually intuitively acknowledge that there is no real solid evidence supporting what they're saying is the absolute truth.
Yeah, and I think that is, you know, a big point, you know. If your kids are vaccinated and they work, you have nothing to fear from my kids. And the herd immunity, you know, ideal is the response to that,
right,
which I don't buy it, you know, personally.
No.
You know, and but that's why we're having these conversations. We want people to be able to hear something different than what they're told in the mainstream media.
Absolutely. And when you look at the justification for herd immunity, you would assume that in highly vaccine-compliant populations, you can look at different outbreaks throughout history in various states in this country. All those studies are on Greenmed Info. I have an entire section dedicated to the research that shows 95 or 99% compliance for, say, MMR, and then they have this massive measles outbreak. So if it were true, then we wouldn't be seeing that. If that were true, China, which has one of the highest compliance rates because it's mandatory for vaccination for measles, is consistently having outbreaks of measles, then there is absolutely no justification for the herd immunity concept. So on every level, the evidence does not support what you and I know is true. You can't poison or infect someone into better health. That model is really based on a very almost barbaric and infantile intellectual model.
And the leverage, like with Gardasil especially, you know, as with all vaccines, but especially Gardasil at this point, there's your, you know, adolescent teenage daughter there, the leverage is fear.
Yes.
Right? So, because what you say, yeah, how do you, you don't inject yourself to better health, you know, I mean, that's not, you know, there's a different view on that, on, you know, how health is created, and that's a whole conversation of itself. But how can we get people to do something that might be counterintuitive, might be even seemingly irrational to them, is fear.
Yes.
How would you feel if you don't make this decision, if your kid gets, you know, cervical cancer?
Exactly.
It's on you.
Yes.
It's a guilt. It's fear. It's all those toxic negative things which actually cause people to be sick.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, that's exactly it. The fear that the medical establishment often uses, especially in vaccine context as well as cancer, itself creates the very thing that they're saying is going to happen, because fear induces the fight or flight. It's immunosuppressive technically.
Yeah. Yes.
So it is really very much a reality that the virus of fear is actually the real pathogen that is infecting people with the notion that this ritual, because it is truly like a Eucharist or drinking the Kool-Aid, you know, at some type of cult event, is that they believe that once they have accepted the libations from up high and that they're super protected, that now, you know, they somehow have a special power that is not conferred to them by the natural state of things.
That's such a great metaphoric use of language, you know, the virus of fear. And what's interesting is that it's kind of baked into the traditional medical research model. And this is the thing that's tougher than, you know, the vitalistic aspect of this, meaning in order for, you know, evidence on the highest level for them is a randomized controlled clinical trial, right?
Yes.
And what's the control? It's a placebo control, a sham.
Yes.
So what are they saying?
Yes.
That your mind and what it thinks has a physiologic effect that affects outcomes and health expression.
Yes.
It's baked into their model because they have to recognize it, but at the same time, they try to ignore it to the application of what they do.
That is such a powerful point.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If the whole basis for evidence-based medicine is to control for the placebo, which represents the power of one's belief and the power of self-healing, actually, in the traditional clinical setting of the patient and the doctor, it is actually a ritualistic relationship where you outsource your agency. You believe that that individual has the power to heal either through a pill or through them caring or not caring. We know that the placebo-nocebo effect is as powerful as declaring you dead or alive, really. And so that Eucharistic pill or vaccine that you put your belief in is actually just an illusion, because it's the body's ability to heal that we, you know, of course, eschew for this model. So ultimately, evidence-based medicine is founded on an acknowledgement that the overriding, supervening power to heal or not heal is within yourself, right, or the patient's belief.
And as you described, the nocebo is saying, if you don't do this, we're going to put fear into you, which is going to create adverse health outcomes as a consequence. So the whole system, in a way, it's rigged. As compared to making an empowered choice, even if somebody chose to vaccinate, that they could do it based on saying, I feel empowered to make this choice for a good reason,
yes,
as compared to say, I'm going to inject you, metaphorically speaking, with fear to get you to do something. So it the whole thing is just built wrong. It's manipulative,
yes,
on a psycho-spiritual level.
Yes.
And the consequence of that... When you take that and you give it to an entire culture,
yes,
you know, it's so chilling that I start to feel nausea in my stomach as I consider the full implications.
It's like the subtle difference between fasting and starving.
Right.
If I choose to fast, it ultimately will probably result in a healing effect. But what's happening is that by then defining our relationship to this question as a matter of compulsory medical intervention versus my freedom to choose, is that by definition, if I can't choose to vaccinate on my own accord with informed consent, then I am chattel, literally.
Yeah.
I don't have bodily self-possession. You're defining my body and my children's bodies as, you know, property of the state. And that is the biggest problem here. The implication people don't realize, it's not just about health freedom in a more academic sense. It's about our relationship to, the universe. Are we free? Are we slaves? Like, you know, do I own my body? Are my children really my own? And that's fundamentally what's at play here. And it does make me existentially sick thinking that is what's happening. That they can knock on my door and say, your child isn't vaccine compliant. You're abusing them because of that. We're going to take them away and we're going to force vaccinate them. That is actually what is set up now legally as an imminent possibility if we don't get this information out to people.
And I think it's got to be power to the people. The only way that this gets changed is through information. I'm not here to try to tell anybody what to do.
Yes.
I'm just asking them to think and to look at the full range of the information and to make an informed choice. And anybody who's got an agenda in my mind other than that,
yes,
it's something that's malicious and anti-human.
Thank you, because without informed choice, you can't have consent, really.
That's right.
And that's all that we're saying, is that the information, both good and not so good, should be presented and available. And if that public has access to it, there isn't really this war, really. It's just people being able to exercise freedom. And then if there are risks or consequences, then they still take responsibility for
right.
it. But without that choice, without information, then this is truly a totalitarian situation that is an abusive violation of our health freedom.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing information with this audience so that they can be empowered to really make choices that are right for them.
Thank you.
Welcome, Barbara. It's lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you, too.
Do me a favor and tell me a little bit about your organization and how you started it, how it came to be, some of the history in the background.
Well, the National Vaccine Information Center used to be known as Dissatisfied Parents Together, or DPT, because we were founded by parents whose children had been injured or died from the DPT vaccine. We don't use that vaccine here in the United States anymore. We now use the DTaP vaccine, but DPT is used around the world in other countries.
Can you tell me what year we stopped using that vaccine?
That vaccine was the safer vaccine, a or the less reactive vaccine, was licensed in 1996, but DPT continued to be used for several years after that. So I'd say probably by 1999, 2000, we were no longer using DPT. They used up all the old stocks. Even though the less reactive vaccine was licensed, they continued to use up the existing stocks. So it took several years to get that off.
Was that a mandate, or was that just like voluntarily changed over? I'm just curious.
It was voluntarily changed over. We wanted DPT taken off the market, but it was never taken off the market. It's still a licensed vaccine in this country.
So some people still might use it.
To my knowledge, doctors are not ordering it. It's not being used. It just, we wanted it off the market. Mm-hmm. It was never taken off the market.
Got
it was simply replaced with DTaP vaccine. Mm-hmm. The acellular version of the whole cell pertussis vaccine.
So what year was the National Vaccine Information Center started?
The National Vaccine Information Center was, that used to be to Satisfy Parents Together, was started in 1982. And then by the late 1980s, we opened the National Vaccine Information Center because we went from focusing on DPT vaccine to focusing on all vaccines.
Okay. And so you started it because of a personal story, or you were a nurse, or what's your background?
I co-founded the National Vaccine Information Center with other parents in the Washington, D.C. area whose children had been brain injured or had died from the whole cell pertussis vaccine and DPT. I was a co-founder because my son had had a severe reaction to his fourth DPT shot when he was 2.5 years old in 1980. And I came from a family of doctors and nurses. My mother was a nurse, my grandma was a nurse, uncles, and my grandfather was a doctor. I graduated from college. I considered myself to be an educated woman, particularly in the area of science and medicine. And I had been told nothing about the risks associated with DPT vaccine. I was told nothing by my pediatrician about how to recognize a vaccine reaction. And so when my son was vaccinated, got his fourth DPT shot, and I took him home, I did not realize what I was witnessing within hours of that DPT shot when I witnessed his serious vaccine reaction. What I saw was a child sitting in a chair, staring straight ahead as if he couldn't see me in the doorway. I called out his name. I saw his eyes roll back into his head until I saw the whites of his eyes. His head fell to his shoulder like he'd fallen asleep sitting up. I tried to wake him up. I could not wake him up. I picked him up. He was like a dead weight. I put him in his bed. He just laid there for hours. I finally called my mother, who was a nurse, and she said, "You have to wake him up." And so I went upstairs. I yelled at him. He did not stir. I got into the bed. I put his back against my chest. I rolled from calling his name, I was rolling from side to side, "Chris, Chris, Chris." He finally struggled to consciousness. He was basically unconscious in his bed. But I didn't understand that. I thought he was taking a long nap. I knew that he had 3 weeks earlier, he had had a bout with the stomach flu. They had given him antibiotics. It was a 48-hour bout with the flu back in 1980. They gave everybody antibiotics. I thought, well, maybe he's having a relapse. Maybe he just needs to sleep. Mm-hmm. But he was unconscious in his bed, and I didn't understand that because I had not been told how to recognize the vaccine reaction. He struggled to consciousness. I carried him. He said, I couldn't understand what he was saying. He couldn't stand up. I carried him in the bathroom. He had violent diarrhea. I brought him back, cleaned him up, brought him back, and he went back to sleep for about 12 more hours. Now, he woke up the next day, but in the succeeding days and months, he regressed. Physically, mentally, and emotionally.
And he was 4.5 at this
point? He was 2.5 years old. And he was actually the brightest of my three children as a baby. He started saying words at 7 months. He was speaking in full sentences by the age of 2. He knew his alphabet. He knew his numbers up to 20. He was recognizing words in the books that we read together every day. He was an extremely focused kid. He memorized the deck of cards. He would flip them over and name them. He was 2.5 years old. And so he was a very precocious child. After that shot, he no longer could do the things that he had done before.
It was very clear, like, very quickly. It wasn't like...
He would no longer read the books with me. He didn't know his alphabet. He couldn't recite the numbers. He was, like, fragile emotionally. He was extremely frustrated because he couldn't do the things that he I think, remember that he could do. Mm-hmm. So he was he would get angry very quickly. He couldn't concentrate. He didn't want to play with the cards anymore. He was constantly had respiratory infections, ear infections, which he had never had before. He had this constant diarrhea. He became very emaciated, failure to thrive. I kept taking him to the doctor, and they told me it was just a stage he was going through and not to worry about it. Well, he never returned to the health that he had before that shot.
When did you start thinking or linking it to the shot? I mean, if it was so clear, you know, what were you thinking those days after that shot?
My doctors told me they didn't know what was wrong with him. I mean, I eventually had him tested at a hospital. They thought he might have cystic fibrosis or celiac disease. Everything came back normal, and they told me that I just needed to take him home and love him. And it wasn't until I saw DPT Vaccine Roulette, which was a documentary produced here in Washington, D.C. by Lee Thompson, who eventually became the reporter for 2020. And that show was the first time, it was the spring of 1982, it was the first time that American parents had been told that vaccines could brain damage children. And I stood there in my kitchen, and I looked at that television, and I said, I wonder if that's what happened to my son.
That was the year I started my pediatric internship. I didn't get told that. I was never told that. But, you know, which is so interesting, right?
Yes. I mean, obviously a lot of doctors are not taught about vaccine risks and reactions.
How is your son today?
Well, Chris had to be placed. He was eventually diagnosed with minimal brain damage, ADD, dyslexia, short-term memory delay, fine motor skill delay, auditory processing deficit. His learning disabilities were so severe that he had to be placed into a self-contained classroom, a special ed classroom for the learning disabled from elementary through middle and high school. Chris is an amazing kid. He's not a kid anymore. He's a man. He's in his mid-30s. He has worked really hard to compensate for those learning disabilities. He is a videographer, and he's also a competitive powerlifter.
Wow.
And he and I both know how lucky he was. I think if Chris had gotten 8 to 10 vaccines that day instead of DPT, he also got oral polio vaccine that day, I think he could have died in his bed that night, or I think he would have been severely brain injured. The fact that I woke him up, brought him to consciousness even momentarily, I think was very important in stopping what could have been a worse brain inflammation.
Is the DPT that you're talking about, is that the same vaccine that was implicated or found to be the cause of some of the SIDS cases that were happening in the 70s?
Well, that's a very famous case. In the late 1970s, I talk about that in my book that I co-authored with Harris Coulter, DPT, A Shot in the Dark. We talk about the Tennessee SIDS deaths. And what happened there was that at the time, the manufacturers of DPT were sending lots of DPT to specific areas of the country. So in this case, there was a lot of DPT that was sent to Tennessee. There were a number of sudden deaths after receipt of the DPT vaccine in infants. They were clustered because the lot was sent to Tennessee. We call it hot lots of DPT vaccine, where there are a high number of deaths reported or brain injury cases reported. Of course, the parents started to talk with each other. It started to become obvious that there were a lot of deaths occurring after DPT vaccine. And the CDC held a meeting, and they talked about how, well, maybe it wasn't such a great idea to send the lots to one section of the country. Today, they disperse the lots. They don't send lots of vaccine to a specific part of the country like they used to do.
Why would they do that? Wouldn't that just make it more difficult to spot a bad lot of vaccines?
Well, I don't think the government has actually ever admitted that there are bad lots of DPT vaccine or hot lots of vaccine. The manufacturers made the decision that they were no longer going to distribute a lot to one part of the country. That was a manufacturer decision. One would think that a manufacturer of a product would want to know if their product was especially reactive and take steps to make it safer.
Yes, one would think that. So, okay, so fast forward, I also think you might have something that you could tell us about the National Vaccine Court, because unless I'm not understanding this correctly, wasn't your group instrumental in forming this court?
Yes.
So could you tell me a little bit about
that? Well, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986 was a law that the drug companies and the doctors wanted passed very badly. In the early 1980s, after our organization formed, and after there was a lot of publicity because of the film DPT Vaccine Roulette, there were a lot of lawsuits that were lodged against the vaccine manufacturers and against negligent physicians, but mostly the manufacturers. There were a couple of very high-profile cases where there was a high award made. Mm-hmm. Most of these cases back in the early 1980s were being settled on the courthouse steps for very low amounts for these children, with the stipulation that all of the records associated with the case would be sealed from public view. So what a lot of people don't realize is because the drug companies had deep pockets, and the plaintiff's lawyers and the parents did not, these cases were being settled for very low amounts. The drug companies, however, knew that they needed to shut down all lawsuits. The pediatricians also didn't really want to be subjected to civil liability. So they went to Congress and they said, you know what? You need to protect the vaccine supply. The drug companies actually threatened to leave the country with no childhood vaccines unless they were protected from liability. At the time, we had just formed our organization, and several members of Congress came to us and said, you can come to the table and fight for what you feel the family should get, but we are going to protect the vaccine supply in this country, and we're going to pass a piece of legislation whether you come to the table or not. And so we came as young parents. We came and did the best we could. What we wanted was a choice, either federal compensation or being able to go to court to sue the companies or negligent physicians. But that's not what we got, because we had no political power. We had no money. We were just a young organization. There was no public awareness whatsoever, except for this one documentary that had been released. There was no information out there. We had no cell phones. We had no internet. We didn't have personal computers. We didn't have even fax machines, okay? I mean, it was a whole different time.
Right.
We did the best we could, but we wanted choice. Our organization was responsible for getting the vaccine safety informing, recording, and reporting provisions in that law. That was our unique contribution. That is that they would have to centralize the vaccine adverse event reporting system. Physicians in the public health clinics were reporting vaccine reactions to the CDC. The private doctors were reporting to the FDA. We insisted that they centralize that system. We did get that in that law. And the modern day vaccine adverse event reporting system is as a result of that law. We wanted the doctors to write down in the permanent medical record the symptoms of vaccine reaction, so that they would travel with the child. We wanted them to be compelled to report vaccine-associated injuries, deaths, and hospitalizations to this reporting system. We wanted them to give parents ahead of time vaccine benefit and risk information and a description of what the reaction looked like, so that parents like me would be able to know after vaccination what to look for. We did all these things, and they were part of this law, but they're not enforced.
So is it law that doctors have to give informed consent on vaccines?
It is a federal law under the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act that doctors are supposed to give parents ahead of time written information about the benefits and risks of vaccines and a description of vaccine reactions. Now, the vaccine information statement that the CDC publishes is partly in existence because of that law and that safety provision. Now, we know that a lot of doctors don't give parents anything because there's no punishment or sanction in the law for not complying with the safety provisions. The National Vaccine Information Center believes that the federal vaccine safety provisions should be codified into state law, and we are going to work to do that so that the states say, at least to the physicians in their state, you have to obey these safety provisions.
What percentage do you think, or how common do you think it is, that doctors report adverse reactions to the system?
Well, we know from several studies that have been done, I think it was in the 1990s, that only between 1 and 10% of the reactions, injuries, deaths that occur after vaccination are actually reported to the federal government. So there is a very low compliance rate with reporting. A study in 2009 that actually had to do with Merck's Gardasil vaccine, where they looked at the vaccine adverse event reporting system and reports coming in there regarding Gardasil. And what they found was that the majority of doctors who do report vaccine reactions are reporting to the drug company.
Oh.
And then the drug company, the majority of reports that they forward to the FDA and CDC are of such poor quality that the FDA and CDC employees can't even use those reports to publish post-marketing surveillance reports on what is happening out there. It's a broken system.
Well, the reason I had asked you is I mentioned that I started a pediatric, I trained in pediatrics. It's one of the things that I trained in, and we were never given a list of vaccine reactions to look for or to tell our patients. We were told they could have fever and to expect fever and not to vaccinate a child who was sick with anything, was sick with fever or even a severe cold, not to vaccinate them because it could put them at risk. But we were never told at risk for what. And so that's why I was asking you. I mean, if pediatricians aren't being trained what to look for in vaccine reactions, how can they then actually report reactions if they don't know what they're looking for or if they don't even know that there are reactions?
Well, certainly the Centers for Disease Control and the American Academy of Pediatrics are not doing the job they need to do to warn doctors that they need to be aware of vaccine reactions, and they need to report those reactions to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. However, I have to say that doctors and pediatricians have not been listening to the mothers who are telling them, and I know they've been telling them, my child got these vaccines and then started screaming in a way I never heard the child scream before, arching his or her back, high fever, collapsing in my arms, so sleepy I can't wake the child up, losing skills. I mean, these things have been reported to doctors, but I believe that doctors do not want to acknowledge that something that they've done to a child, i.e. given a vaccine that they thought was going to keep that child well, actually hurt the child. And this denial has played a big role in doctors turning the other way and ignoring what is happening in front of their noses.
How do you think the nurses look at this? I mean, do you think there's a, I mean, it sounds like there's a disconnect, because I agree that parents do come in and make these comments. And I remember training, we were always taught that actually the mother knows best, that if a mother tells you the child is sick, listen to the mother. But we would sometimes, when the mother would say, oh, no, my child is fine until the vaccines, the attending would be like, oh, she's crazy. You know, they would be like, you know, you can listen to the mother, but to a point. You listen to the mother about their kid, but if the mother says that the child had a bad reaction to the vaccine.
Well, I mean, I have to ask you that question. You're a doctor, and you were a pediatric emergency room doctor. Why would you only believe the mother up to a certain point? Why did you not want to go that extra step and say, well, it might have been the vaccine?
You know, I actually always wondered about that, and I did listen to the mother. It kind of didn't make sense to me, and there were two occasions where we saw kids come into the emergency room who had been vaccinated that day because they had stopped breathing or had a seizure. And one of the attendings said to me and said, turned to me and said, I said that kid was in the clinic. You know, that kid received vaccines today. And one of the attendings turned to me and said, it's probably a vaccine reaction. So there were mixed messages, and it was very confusing. But no, I remember thinking that some kids are going to be very sensitive and react badly to vaccines, that must be the case. Why I would get messages, you know, when we were training from attendings, you know, some attendings would say, listen to the mother's always know best. And then other attendings would be, you know, no, there's no way that the kid had a reaction to the vaccines. But some attendings did say it. I mean, it was really, there was no consensus, or at least openly there was no consensus.
But as a doctor who was giving vaccines to children, was there at any point, did you ever stop and say, I wonder if giving this vaccine to this child is going to cause a reaction?
when I was in my training, I actually didn't. I would tell the parent, you know, in those days, we did not vaccinate children who were sick. I think that's very different now, but
it is.
It is very different. I think now, I've read articles where it says, oh, it doesn't matter, you can give kids who have fever or neurological disabilities. We didn't vaccinate children. We would delay their vaccinations, and we would delay vaccinations in premature babies as well. And I remember telling the parents that, you know, watch for fever. And we also didn't give a lot of vaccines. I don't remember giving more than the DPT and the OPV. I mean, this was the early 80s. That's what I remember giving. And I was a resident. So once I had a choice out of residency, I chose not to be a vaccine giver. Even though I didn't know all that I know now, I chose not to be a vaccine giver. I ran an emergency room, mm-hmm. and then I went into private practice where I was a consultant for chronic mm-hmm. illness and didn't have to vaccinate. I wasn't a primary care provider.
When my children were being vaccinated in the late 70s and 80s, there were only 23 doses of 7 vaccines that children were given. Today, the CDC recommends 69 doses of 16 vaccines starting on the day of birth at 12 hours of age with hepatitis B vaccine through age 18. 49 doses of those vaccines are given before the age of 6. This is a very, very different experience that our children are having. Their immune systems are developing in a very different way today than they did when they were being given far fewer vaccines. And one of the points that I've been making for the last 20 years is, at the same time we've tripled the numbers of doses of vaccines we're giving our children, we have seen this increase in chronic immune and brain dysfunction, like my son suffered after he got his shot in 1980. We're seeing 1 in 6 child in America now is learning disabled. 1 in 9 has asthma. 1 in 50 is diagnosed with autism. And 1 in 400 has diabetes. This is a tripling of the numbers of children who are chronically ill and disabled in our country. And what a lot of people in America don't know is that America gives their children, our children, more vaccines than any other nation. When you look at the European Union, 15 nations in the European Union don't even mandate vaccines, any vaccines. And yet we are giving our children so many vaccines, and there's no explanation as to why our children are so chronically ill and disabled, why we have to keep building so many special education classrooms. When my son was going to school in the early 1980s, there were just a few schools with special education classrooms. Now every school has one. And I certainly think you cannot take off the table the potential connection between atypically manipulating the immune system over and over again with the use of multiple vaccines in the early developmental period and this chronic disease and disability epidemic.
So let me ask you, the few countries that do model our vaccine schedule, which I believe are Korea, Vietnam now is modeling. Have you been in touch with similar parallel groups as your group? Have they reached out to you? Have you reached out to them? I know that autism is way on the rise in Korea and Vietnam. I know all these autoimmune diseases are on the rise in these countries that have heavy vaccine schedules compared to the countries you were referring to, which don't even mandate vaccines, but have and there's some that are recommended, but it's a much lower rate and much less vaccination.
Right.
So have you had any contact with parallel groups in some of these other countries?
Well, all along in the last 30 years, we have had contact with some of the groups in Europe, in Australia, in New Zealand. They don't have as strict an enforcement of mandatory vaccination, and they don't recommend in those countries as many vaccines as we do. You're right that a lot of countries now are taking a look at our model and are trying to imitate it. Our country has used more vaccines than any other country, and it's mostly about the strict enforcement of the mandatory vaccination laws in this country that's very different from other countries. When I took a look at the European Union, I found it very interesting that 8 or 9 countries that do have mandatory vaccination are the countries that were formerly behind the Iron Curtain. I think that that's one of the reasons that our organization has always strongly advocated for the inclusion of informed consent protections in vaccine policies and laws, and why we place such an emphasis on trying to protect vaccine exemptions, including the non-medical exemptions, like the religious and conscientious belief exemption. Because as we were talking previously, Almost nothing today qualifies as an official medical contraindication to vaccination. Before the law was passed in 1986, there were more contraindications and precautions that you and other doctors who were giving vaccines were told about, and you were more careful. Now, almost nothing qualifies as a medical reason to not vaccinate. So doctors are vaccinating even after children have exhibited clear vaccine reactions, including convulsions, because that's what the official guidelines tell them to do. So very few doctors will write a medical exemption.
Let me ask you, in the studies, in the vaccine studies, children with convulsions are exempted. Typically they don't include very young children, they don't include children with autoimmune diseases or children with neurological, severe neurological disorder or seizures. So if they're not in the studies, how can they be considered safe for those children?
These pre-licensure clinical studies we call whitewashed groups because they do not accept into those studies often children who have had a history of convulsions, children who are sick at the time of vaccination, even in some studies, children who have a family history of certain kinds of immune and brain disorders. It's a very whitewashed population that is studied in the pre-licensure trials. However, after the vaccine is licensed and recommended for universal use by children, suddenly there are no contraindications or very, very few. To me, when you have so few medical contraindications, and you have very limited study pre-licensure, when the vaccine is released for public use, it's in a way, it's an uncontrolled experiment because the post-marketing surveillance is not real rigorous either. Certainly vaccine reaction reporting is not rigorous. So, you know, you have a situation where really the people do need to have the information and they need to have the freedom to make vaccine choices without being sanctioned and punished for making those choices.
Now, in the state of Virginia, I believe it is, I have been told, because it's come on my lap, to look at a case that's going on there right now where a child got a medical exemption. But the state is now saying that doctors can't make the medical exemptions. It has to be a state health official. Are you aware of this? Can you tell us about that?
I mean, this has been an increasing trend where you have on the books in states that a medical exemption is allowed. But when a doctor tries to write a medical exemption that does not strictly conform to the contraindication guidelines of the Centers for Disease Control, the state health officials come in and say, sorry, your medical exemption is not valid. The reasons you put down there are not valid. My organization believes that in this country, a licensed doctor, medical doctor, or a state-designated health worker, because they are designating other health workers to give vaccines, should be able, if in his or her professional opinion, that child or that adult is not a candidate for vaccination, that medical exemption, irregardless of whether it conforms to the federal guidelines, that doctor should be able to give a medical exemption. I mean, this is just, it's not right for a medical professional giving vaccines if they believe that a child is not a candidate or an adult is not a candidate, that they aren't prevented from giving a medical exemption. This puts way too many people at risk.
Well, it's interesting because about a year ago, I saw a child whose sibling had been obviously damaged from a vaccine, had very severe reactions, had Guillain-Barré, and so I wrote a medical exemption for this child, and we got a letter back from the state explaining that that child had to have had a bad reaction to the vaccine in order for me to write a medical exemption for vaccination,
right.
Which I was like, but that's confusing because that means that the child has to have a bad reaction in order for you to say, okay, he right. doesn't have to have, I mean, it seems contrary to prevention. So if there's a tendency with that genetics to have a bad reaction, I was trying to protect the sibling. I don't know if you've run into that now with states.
Absolutely. And I don't think a lot of doctors know, and certainly not a lot of parents know, that the Institute of Medicine has published two very important studies in the last 2 years. In 2012, they published a report that acknowledged individual susceptibility to suffering vaccine reactions and injury. And they pointed out that these individual susceptibilities could include genetic variation, environmental factors, behaviors, etc. And what they said was that some of these high-risk factors are known, but some are not known. Mm-hmm. And then they published a report in 2013 that said, we've looked at the childhood schedule, the current childhood schedule, and what we find is there have not been enough systematic studies of the safety of the childhood schedule when you look at it in total. That is, individual vaccines have been looked at, but when a new vaccine is added to the existing schedule, that has not been systematically studied. So there are gaps in vaccine science knowledge. And when doctors cannot predict ahead of time who is going to be injured, it means that we as consumers must have the right to exercise informed consent to vaccination. We should not be forced to use vaccines if we believe our children are at risk genetically or biologically or for other reasons. We should not be forced. I mean, certainly a mother in my position where I have a child who was injured by a vaccine shouldn't be forced to vaccinate my other children with the same vaccine that damaged my child when I have good reason to believe that my genetics, we have a biological susceptibility in my family. And I'm really sensitive to this because my family has a lot of autoimmune disorders. Mm. Mm-hmm. Okay, my mother died of lupus. We have thyroid disorders in my family. We have severe allergies to medicines, to like penicillin, and to environmental allergens. We have Parkinson's in my family. There are neurological and autoimmune disorders in my family that I believe make my family at risk, genetically and biologically. How is a state public policy moral if, in taking a one-size-fits-all approach to vaccination, a no-exceptions, one-size-fits-all approach, that actually selects the genetically vulnerable for sacrifice without their consent? That's not a moral policy.
I agree with you. I have no argument for that. In fact, I find it contrary to the policy where, you know, we need to vaccinate everyone for the few who can't be vaccinated. Well, who are those few? I mean, it sounds like there really isn't. They're not allowing the few who can't be vaccinated to not be vaccinated, you know, to go unvaccinated. But that begs the question of, well, isn't it an ethical responsibility in society to prevent outbreaks? And, you know, there's been, especially we've been seeing measles and pertussis and mumps outbreaks. And isn't it, you know, the argument on the other side is, and the argument that many bioethicists take is, isn't it the moral obligation for everyone to vaccinate their children? Although they all tend to say that they're against adult forced vaccination because adults should be able to make up their own minds, but therefore all for forced childhood vaccination because it's the duty to prevent outbreaks.
My duty as a mother who gave birth to a child, it's my duty to make sure that my child is nurtured and remains healthy until my child can take care of his or herself. My duty is not to sacrifice my child on the altar of vaccination because doctors are not going to acknowledge that my child may be at high risk for biological or genetic reasons to react into a vaccine. That is not, my job is not to do that. My job is to protect my child. Now, vaccines also don't always work. Vaccines are given to healthy people, unlike drugs that are given to sick people. And when you go in to get a vaccination or your child goes in to get a vaccination, you take two risks. A risk that the vaccine will injure or kill the child, or a risk the vaccine won't work. And what a lot of people don't realize is there are a lot of vaccine failures that are not being recognized and not being admitted to. And pertussis vaccine is the best example. Influenza vaccine is another example, but certainly pertussis vaccine. Both the whole cell vaccine and the acyclovir vaccine have a high failure rate. So what we have in this country, really, and around the world, is herd immunity that has been generated by both naturally acquired immunity as well as temporary vaccine-acquired immunity. The CDC has said in the last few years, those who are not vaccinated for pertussis are not to blame for the outbreaks. This is not a failure to vaccinate. It's a vaccine failure. They know that the current acellular vaccine only lasts for 2 to 5 years in terms of immunity. The whole cell vaccine did not have a high efficacy rate either. It was, it depended upon the manufacturer, it was anywhere from like 40 to 80%. The person coughing next to you in the elevator that has pertussis may be vaccinated or may be unvaccinated. When they make the argument that for the greater good, everyone must get vaccinated, they are discriminating against those people who have biological susceptibility to having a vaccine reaction, injury, or death.
Well, the other question you could ask is, if vaccines were working, why would it matter if somebody next to you wasn't vaccinated?
I think that's a really good point, because the companies shouldn't get a free pass on both being protected from liability for vaccine injuries and deaths, and also get a free pass on vaccine failures.
Well, you know, people who travel, if you go to the CDC website, and there's recommendations when you're going to third world countries, and certain countries will say, oh, you must get this vaccine, this vaccine, this vaccine. And in those situations, they really push those vaccines. Well, when you go to those countries, no one else is usually vaccinated against those things. And so, well, does the vaccine only work if everyone else is vaccinated, or do vaccines for travel work? You know, this is a confusing, also mixed message on the part of the CDC, I believe.
It comes back to the product. Either the vaccine works, and when you get vaccinated, you're protected.
And then it wouldn't matter.
That's right, in which case you would not have anything to fear from the unvaccinated.
Well, the other interesting thing that you reminded me of is when I was, because now I'm thinking about when I trained in pediatrics, and one of the things, you know, we had a big cancer ward. One of the things that was really pushed on us was that, you know, children with cancer should not be around children who've been vaccinated, because children who've been recently vaccinated can spread
vaccines.
Exactly. Right. But yet the media seems to have twisted that around on its head in a way that it seems like kids who aren't vaccinated are spreading disease, whereas, you know, the way we were taught were it was the kids who had just been vaccinated were actually the ones that could spread disease.
Right. The media didn't come up with that idea on their own. They were carefully led. It reminds me of the chickenpox vaccine. Mm. In 1995, when that vaccine was licensed, my organization opposed the mandating of that vaccine because it was originally developed for leukemic children who cannot get through a bout with chickenpox without having a horrible complication or dying. But, of course, the manufacturer of the vaccine didn't want it to be an orphan drug, didn't want it to just be for children with leukemia. They wanted a much bigger market. And so when that vaccine came out in 1995, it was supposed to be a voluntary vaccine. Within 5 years, all of a sudden, the lobbying started in the states to make that a required vaccine. And indeed, now it is generally required by most states.
Well, that's an interesting one because, again, I made it to age 26 without chickenpox. And
really?
And when I started my pediatric internship, I told the head of my internship, you know, I didn't have chickenpox. He said, I don't believe you. So we did titers. And the day the titers came back was a day I had 102 fever. I was working in the emergency room. I had been on call in the cancer ward the night before. And a nurse looked at me and said, what's on your arms and your face? And it was a day. And I said, what are you talking about? I feel horrible. I had chickenpox. My titers came back that day. I didn't, of course, I had not had chickenpox as a child. But because of that, they went and it was an experimental vaccine in those days. It was early 80s. And we had to vaccinate the children I had exposed in the cancer ward. But my attending also said, you know, we'll never mandate this vaccine. This vaccine will never be a recommended, let alone mandated, let alone recommended vaccine, because the risk would never be worth the benefit. Fast forward 10 years later, and now it's mandated, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was, you know, I remember thinking, wait, in my training we were told it would never be, let alone mandated, it would never even be a recommended vaccine because the risks would never outweigh the benefit. And that was an attending who actually always said, look, there's always a risk to vaccine. There's always going to be some kids who die. Chickenpox, you know, there's 100 deaths a year, half of children, and that's in the whole United States.
Yeah, you're
right. And those were, and, you know, I went and looked that up because I've done research since then. And those were, again, children who were on chemo for the most part. And 100 out of several million, we're talking about several million people. So it's really a low risk illness. But when I went back to look at that, I don't know if you're aware of the the predictions. The mathematical biologists all did these mathematical models and showed that if we mandate or recommend this vaccine and everyone goes out and gets it, we're going to shift the disease burden from chickenpox to shingles.
Well, actually, we predicted that. I mean, our organization said if you require all the children to get the chickenpox vaccine, what you're going to do is you're no longer going to have asymptomatic boosting among the children who, as they get to be teenagers and adults, so that you have a lengthening of the immunity. You're going to have the chickenpox virus stays in the body, and you're going to have a reactivation later in life, and it'll take the form of shingles, because varicella zoster is a herpes virus, just like herpes zoster. It's in the same family. They can't explain why some people have a reactivation of the varicella zoster virus. At least I haven't seen an explanation. But the thing is that you're right. The company that made the chickenpox vaccine, Merck, is now the company that also is the sole producer of shingles vaccine.
A natural progression for almost all childhood diseases is you get the disease as a child, mm-hmm. you have antibodies, and frequent or every few years you're re-exposed to that disease.
Right.
It boosts your immunity.
Right.
So the reason we would see very elderly people getting shingles is typically because they were no longer exposed to grandchildren
right.
anymore. They were in nursing homes,
right.
and so there was no opportunity for them to be exposed. And so without the boosting of their antibodies, they would now be mm-hmm. susceptible, if they were stressed, to having an outbreak, and it would be an outbreak of shingles. And so it's not just with shingles. It's the same thing with pertussis, with measles.
Mm-hmm.
This is how a lot of these childhood diseases have worked, is that we were re-exposed over our years and kept our immunity.
Right. You're exactly right. A lot of people think that because they've had chickenpox, or they've had measles, or they've had pertussis, they get permanent immunity. And actually, what's happening is you're getting a boosting of the immunity, because you have a qualitatively superior immunity from naturally acquired immunity versus artificial vaccine-acquired immunity. And I think it's really interesting, when you go in the medical literature, you see the scientists describing vaccine immunity as artificial immunity.
Well,
it's
we know
not
that
natural immunity.
That's right. And if you look at the antibody, the transplacental antibody,
exactly.
So it's actually longer, you know, if the mother had real disease,
right,
and they're all a little different, but let's say measles, mm-hmm. really had measles, the antibody protection for the infant is much longer than if she mm-hmm. had vaccine-induced measles. So people don't realize it, and you're right. Most doctors that I talk to and interview are really clueless as to how our body deals with things naturally. It's not even being taught in the medical schools whatsoever, because I've talked to pediatricians who had no idea that you needed mm-hmm. to be re-exposed to chickenpox mm-hmm. to boost your immunity so you don't get shingles, and I've literally had pediatricians tell me that there's no such thing as having any kind of immunity to pertussis from natural pertussis.
Oh, that's not true.
Of course not. But my point is that what was taught in medical school in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, 60s, and even 70s is no longer being taught in the medical school about immunity. That's really a sad statement.
And I think that a lot of doctors don't realize the Institute of Medicine has said in over 20 years of reports on vaccine adverse events that scientists still do not really understand the biological mechanisms involved in naturally acquired immunity, much less vaccine-acquired immunity. There are big gaps in knowledge about how the immune system works. We know some about how it works, but not totally. And yet the vaccines that are being developed, the hundreds of vaccines that are being developed that will be part of our future, and certainly in the United States, will be mandated with no exceptions unless we can get changes in the laws, are being produced in new ways that involve genetic engineering, involve using of cell substrates we've never used before, adjuvants that will ramp up the immune system to hyperstimulate the immune system. What's going to happen to people like my family who already have a sensitivity to not being able to resolve inflammation? And vaccines cause inflammation in the body, just like an infection causes inflammation in the body. And we can't resolve inflammation, and we have autoimmunity and allergy.
I'm going to correct you. I think they cause inflammation in the body in a different way. Well, because I think in a naturally acquired illness,
yes,
you have other...
But you have to have an inflammatory response and an infection, or else you will not get antibodies.
That's true.
So, I mean, to me, it's about inflammation. It's about chronic inflammation in the body. And one of the things that has bothered me is how doctors want to put labels on things. And I'll give you an example of DPT vaccine. DPT vaccine was associated with infantile spasms. Infantile spasms, also known as the jackknife seizure, has a very serious, catastrophic prognosis. Most of the children who get infantile spasms are severely mentally retarded. Very expensive. What's the first thing that the vaccine policymakers did when we started to talk about DPT vaccine injury? They said, well, seizures, yeah, DPT could cause seizures, but not infantile spasms. Infantile spasms was a label. It's a seizure disorder, but it has a different label. The same thing has happened with autism. Autism is immune and brain dysfunction. Yet when you put the label autism on it, that immune and brain dysfunction, which is part of the vaccine injury spectrum, all of a sudden, it couldn't possibly be caused by vaccines. Labels are so limiting. And I've seen it used to disassociate a condition that has a very poor prognosis from the vaccine injury spectrum. But it's all about brain and immune system dysfunction. Brain damage by any other name is still brain damage.
Where do you think this clamping down on, you know, no longer accepting normal medical exemptions and fighting to get rid of philosophical or religious exemptions and now recommending or really pushing, mandating flu vaccines on healthcare workers, where do you think we're going with this? Where do you think, you know, is this just the beginning? Is this the end point? What's down the pipeline? Do you know?
Well, I think there's no question that that the war on disease has become a war on values and beliefs. And there is a concerted effort to marginalize, demonize, isolate, and sanction people in this country who do not agree with this one-size-fits-all, no-exceptions vaccination approach that's being taken by both medical trade organizations as well as government health officials. Right now, it started with no shots, no school, and that was in the 1970s based around the MMR vaccine. It's gone from no shots, no school to no shots, no health insurance. We have reports of families who are not able to get health insurance coverage unless they agree to all the federally recommended vaccines. No shots, no Medicare or Medicaid. We have seniors who are contacting us now saying that doctors who have treated them for 25 years are now saying, if you don't get the influenza vaccine, shingles vaccine, pneumococcal vaccine, we can't treat you. We have, for many years, received reports from disadvantaged people, poor people who are on government assistance. No shots, no visa. We have reports of people trying to get into this country who, unless they get all the vaccines, won't be able to immigrate. I think that the public health system is becoming militarized. And when you have this marginalization, demonization of people who want to make vaccine choices, I think that we are facing a future that could be very, very oppressive, way more oppressive than it is now, so that there are societal sanctions attached to, and you won't even be able to get a job, I think. Certainly with the healthcare workers, many healthcare workers cannot have a job unless they agree to an annual flu shot and a series of other vaccinations, even if they've got high-risk factors. We have pregnant healthcare workers who are saying they want me to get vaccinated while I'm pregnant. I don't want to get vaccinated while I'm pregnant. We have healthcare workers who have had autoimmune disorders and other things or have had vaccine reactions. No exceptions. You either get the shots or you're out of a job. There's talk about extending it to childcare workers, to teachers, basically to anyone who works with the public, who performs a service for the public. So I really believe that Americans have got to wake up, and they really do need to interface with their state legislators, because vaccine laws are state laws. The federal government recommends, but the states mandate. And the National Vaccine Information Center has an online free advocacy portal where we are encouraging people to come on and use that portal, because it connects you with your legislator with a touch of a smartphone or your computer. Mm. You can go straight to your own legislator and make your voice heard. And until we get active in this country and fight for our right to be able to make informed vaccine choices, I think we're going to be in handcuffs. We're not going to be able to make those choices.
What about the MSHEPA, the bio disaster kind of preparedness act that was passed a few years back? And what does that mean? Does that change the game in terms of federal control over state, in terms of like saying there's a pandemic or approaching pandemic or an approaching epidemic? I mean, does that give the states more power? Does it give the federal government more power? Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, the Model State Health Emergency Powers Act was model legislation that was quickly brought out within weeks of September 11th, 2001. That legislation was created with a grant from the CDC to a lawyer at Georgetown U who had been working on it for some years. And as soon as 9/11 occurred, this model legislation was brought out and was in the states, were lobbied to pass this legislation that basically reformed public health laws, changed public health laws at the state level. And what it did was it expanded the police powers of health officials in the states, that whenever a public health emergency was declared by the governor, who usually follows a federal declaration of emergency, that quite oppressive action could be taken, in that people could be quarantined, people could be forcibly vaccinated without their informed consent.
Since 9/11, we're on high alert. They can do this anytime they want, really, if they wanted to.
Well, I know. I know, because there are other legislation that's been passed at the federal level, which we can also talk about. But certainly, this Model State Health Emergency Powers Act, which my organization opposed because we wanted informed consent protections in any kind of public health policy and law, even in an emergency situation. Some of the states took that model legislation and totally incorporated it. Other states did put, a few states did put some informed consent protections in there. And I think that it's also important for people to realize that after 9/11, there were other pieces of federal legislation that were passed that expanded the vaccine infrastructure at the federal level and built upon federal legislation that had been created in the last 30 years, which really created a public-private financial partnership between the federal government and the pharmaceutical industry. The federal government is now in an actual business partnership with the pharmaceutical industry. And why is this important? Because the federal health agencies are responsible for regulating the safety and effectiveness of vaccines, the FDA specifically. And Congress has seen fit. It is the politicians we've elected, Congress, who has seen fit to create this federal legislation, which actually, what I call it, the pay-for-play scheme, where the companies now pay the FDA to fast-track their vaccines and drugs to licensure.
And explain fast-track.
That is, you can bypass the normal regulatory standards for proof of safety and effectiveness of vaccines and take shortcuts in order to get that product on the market quicker.
Fast Track was created for a reason, though. I'm assuming Fast Track was probably created for an emerging pandemic or epidemic.
No, because that kind of was after 9/11, where that was reinforced. But no, back in the 80s, after the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act was passed in 86, which protected the companies from liability, partial liability, and the doctors got liability protection too, Congress has passed a series of laws in the last 30 years that allow the drug companies to pay the FDA to fast-track their vaccines and drugs to licensure, bypassing normal FDA regulatory standards for proof of safety and effectiveness of the products prior to licensure. They've not only done that, they have put performance goals and deadlines on how many vaccines and drugs should be licensed within a period of time. This has put everything on this fast track. And, you know, I like to think of it as, if you drive fast, you're not also going to be driving safely. If you have government employees who have been told that they are supposed to license a certain number of drugs and vaccines in a certain time period, and you've also told them that they're supposed to make sure they're safe and effective, those are two competing goals that you cannot expect those people to do at the same time. And so there needs to be a reform, really, of these laws so that the
You don't think they're checking them for safety?
I think that when you ask somebody to fast-track something, you're going to have a conflict with making sure that that product is safe and as effective as possible. If you lower the standards and make shortcuts for getting the product to market, how are you going to also be able to assure that that product is as safe and effective as possible? So I really think that something has to change, because really the public interest is not being served when you tell people that they've got to license a certain number of vaccines in a certain time period. And that when you have the companies that are being regulated paying for the fast tracking, that also is not going to ensure safety and effectiveness.
So it's an extra, they pay extra, it's an extra payment to get it to this fast track.
That's
position.
Right. Mm-hmm. And in fact,
do you know how much it is? I'm curious.
No, I don't know exactly
probably
how much
millions,
it is.
Though, I would imagine.
Oh, well, they say that now it's, I believe, 60% of the drug reviews and the vaccine reviews by the FDA is paid for by these user fees from the drug companies. So here we have staffs who are really, their jobs are being funded by the drug companies. It's not the way it should work. We really should make sure that the FDA, the people who are working at the FDA, have one goal, and that is to make sure the product is as safe and effective as it can be. They shouldn't be put on a deadline that they have to license a certain number of vaccines, or they're somehow not going to be funded by Congress.
Out of curiosity, who funds the National Vaccine Information Center? How does it get its funding?
NVIC is funded, has always been funded by individual donations from families. That's how we started out. We actually started out creating a $3 information packet on DPT vaccine and donations. We are supported by healthcare professionals, interestingly, as well as families, both families with healthy children and families who have vaccine-injured children. We're bipartisan. We're not politically aligned with any party. And we're also funded by family foundations, by private foundations. We will not take any money from any government agencies or any corporations that have anything to do with promoting the use of vaccines or making vaccines.
Do you interface at all with the vaccine committee, the advisory committee at the FDA or the advisory committee at the CDC? Have you, you know, gone before them and gone to the meetings or interfaced with them in any way?
Well, I've been a member of the National Vaccine Advisory Committee, the original National Vaccine Advisory Committee. It was created under the 1986 law between 1988 and 1991.
So prior to that, there was no Federal Vaccine Advisory Committee at the
Well,
FDA.
This National Vaccine Advisory Committee is an advisory committee to the Assistant Secretary of HHS. It was created in the 11th hour in the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. What a lot of people don't know is that HHS and Justice opposed the 1986 law. It was only at the 11th hour when they were given certain things like the National Vaccine Advisory Committee, Advisory Commission on Childhood Vaccines, the National Vaccine Program Office, the pediatricians were brought into the coverage, the liability protection, that actually HHS and Justice dropped their opposition to the law.
Why were they opposed to the law?
Because they maintained that vaccines don't cause injury and death. By and large, if it ever happens, it's so rare it's not measurable. They did not want to have an acknowledgement that vaccine injuries and deaths are real and that there should be compensation. So there was opposition to that law until they got certain things. And the National Vaccine Advisory Committee was one thing they got. And I was the consumer member on it in the original committee. I also sat on the Institute of Medicine Vaccine Safety Forum between 1995 and 1998. And actually co-authored one of the reports out of IOM on vaccine risk communication. And then I was the consumer member of the FDA Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee from 1999 till 2002. And I also have participated in public engagement projects with the CDC between 2002 and about 2010. And those were an experiment in participatory democracy, where there was an attempt to engage the public, including the critical public, and the stakeholders, the vaccine stakeholders, came together and had a series of meetings trying to work out issues. It was very interesting. I mean, I've learned a lot when I started to get involved in this. And I wrote A Shot in the Dark, that if I was going to be a critic of the system, I needed to understand why the system and why people operating the vaccine system were so committed to this one-size-fits-all vaccination approach.
And why do you think that is?
The smallpox vaccine put them down a road, on a road, the public health community, on a road that said, we are going to eradicate infectious disease with the mass use of vaccines. We've done it with smallpox vaccine. We're going to do it with polio vaccine. And there's a whole lot of other infectious diseases that we're going to prevent with the mass mandatory use of vaccines. And it's an ideological commitment that says this is going to equal better health for everyone. And they never stop to take a look at whether or not that commitment was a wise commitment. Mm-hmm. And whether or not that one-size-fits-all approach wasn't potentially throwing more people under the bus than they had originally anticipated. So once you commit to a strategy, you know, it becomes like taking that hill. And then they say, well, how many people are we willing to lose to take the hill? And I've said, is it 500? Is it 5,000? Is it 5 million? How many people are you willing to sacrifice to take the hill? And I don't think they've ever answered that question. So, it's put blinders on and don't ask any questions. And I think that the obligation of those of us who have paid the price where the vaccine risks were 100% for our children do have a responsibility to try to encourage those who are taking this one-size-fits-all approach to take a second look at that commitment.
So one more question, which is, it seems like you had the opportunity to be in dialogue with the people who, with the folks that have this one-size-fits-all and are on the Hill. But I have noticed of late that there's been a discouragement to allow the questioning of vaccines to come into the media. And I think Kathleen Sebelius herself made that comment. So my question to you is, have you noticed a change in terms of coverage in the media, coverage in the news? Have you seen that taken to effect? Do you think that people are listening and saying, well, we can't even allow this debate to go on, so we're not going to give coverage to scientists or politicians or people who make policy, who are involved in nonprofits as consumer representatives? We're not going to give them a voice anymore because, you know, Sebelius and the HHS doesn't really want the debate to happen at all.
Well, I think that what happened in the 80s and 90s is there was a civil dialogue in the media. It wasn't easy, but when reporters would come and ask for the other side of the story, they usually, I would say with few exceptions, would treat what we had to say with respect. Now, many times it was still tipped toward protecting the status quo, but something definitely has changed, I would say, since about 2005, 2006, maybe even going back to after 9/11, mm-hmm. when there was this focus on bioterrorism and these weapons of mass destruction that were going to unleash these weaponized microorganisms on our country and other countries, where there was this commitment by the federal government that they needed to create Homeland Security Agency, create BARDA, and other entities that were going to create bioterrorism vaccines. There was this real sort of cold blanket that was put on to the discussion of vaccine risks. But in the last 7 years or so, it's gotten really bad in that there's this demonization of anyone who has another perspective about vaccine safety, which of course includes me and the National Vaccine Information Center. And you know, what really bothers me is that we have never taken a position and never have told anyone not to vaccinate, because intellectually, I find that to be not appropriate. I'm not a medical professional. We are consumer advocates. We don't tell people what to do. We don't give medical advice. What we say is we encourage people to get the information from many different sources. and to make an informed decision. But we certainly defend without compromise the right of that person to make a decision that may be at variance with a doctor or with the federal recommendations. So we're definitely informed consent advocates. Why that's a radical position to take, an informed consent position is radical, doesn't make any sense. If they are threatened by an informed consent position, then I think we need to take a much closer look at what they're afraid of. Because if the vaccines and their vaccine policies are so wonderful, then there wouldn't be so many people asking so many questions. Because the truth is that today, everybody knows somebody who was healthy, got vaccinated, and was never healthy again. And that's what they're afraid of. They're afraid of talking about that. The paradigm is trying to shift from a drug and vaccine-dependent paradigm to one that is more open, that embraces more natural ways of staying healthy. And certainly the drug companies and health officials who have been committed to this old paradigm are scared of this paradigm shift. What they need to do is they need to take a deep breath, and they need to actually embrace it and have a true dialogue. And because the goal is health. It's not who's right and who's wrong. It's about achieving long-term good health in our society, individually and collectively.
My name is Terry Walls. I'm an internal medicine physician, professor of medicine at the University of Iowa. I'm also a staff physician at the Iowa City VA. So clearly, I embraced conventional medicine. You know, I thought the best way to be a great doc, to teach the young medical students, was to use the latest science in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I thought the alternative medicine stuff was a lot of wasted money, and I've thought it quite ironic that we're spending $6 billion a year on these alternative therapies that, in my mind, were unproven and a waste of resources. Now, obviously, that has evolved. I don't see things in that same light. Like many physicians, at one time I believed that we got our diseases because of genes. And now I realize, unfortunately, science began to realize too, it's the epigenetics, it's the environment acting on our genes, shifting the phenotype either from a healthy, wild, vigorous phenotype into an inflamed, sickly, disease-prone phenotype. And 95% of the risk for developing high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, neurological problems, including dementia, psychiatric problems, including schizophrenia, autoimmunity, and cancer, are these epigenetic factors. Diet, lifestyle, toxin exposure, huge. A really critical part of that, of my transition, was that in 2000, I developed weakness in my left leg. I went to see my physician. And during that evaluation, they realized I'd had a problem with my vision 13 years earlier. I had abnormal lesions in my spinal cord, abnormal spinal fluid. I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Being a conventional doc, I knew that within 10 years, a third of people have difficulty walking, needing a cane, walker, or wheelchair. 10 can't work because of severe fatigue. I had young kids. I was the main breadwinner for our family, so I treated my disease aggressively. I sought out the best center I could find, the Cleveland Clinic, took the newest drugs. Within 3 years, my disease had transitioned to secondary progressive MS. I took the recommended chemotherapy, got the tilt recline wheelchair. I took the miracle drug Tysabri, but continued to steadily decline. During that time, once I hit the wheelchair, you know, I'm reading the science because I know the secrets for tomorrow's treatments will be in the lab, basic science labs of today. So I'm reading the animal models of MS and other diseases with shrinking brains. I'm adding vitamins and supplements, slowing my decline, but still declining. I continue to read. I discover neuromuscular electrical stimulation of my muscles. I discover functional medicine. I add a longer list of vitamins and supplements. Then I have this brilliant awareness that I should get these key nutrients from food. So more research to figure out where they are in the food supply. And I redesigned my diet, which, by the way, had been a paleo diet since 2002, to get these 31 key vitamins, minerals, antioxidants. And that's when the magic happens. In 3 months, my fatigue is gone. In 6 months, I'm walking throughout the hospital without a cane. My neurologist sees me. He's very impressed. I tell him I want to go off the disease-modifying drugs. He agrees to taper and discontinue the drugs. At 9 months, I get on my bike for the first time in 5 years. At a year, I do an 18-mile bike ride with my family. At that point, how I see disease and health is fundamentally changed. And that leads to my changing how I practice. I do this radical thing. I ask my patients what they're eating. I ask them about their toxin exposures. I want to know what they're doing for physical activity. I want to know how they're managing their stress. And then I begin teaching them to address these lifestyle issues one after another. I see blood pressures fall, blood sugars normalize, pain diminish, energy improve. And I discover that creating health is the most powerful medication that I have for treating most chronic diseases. I'm often asked the question about vaccines, and I can make some observations and raise more questions. There's an interest, a lot of growing enthusiasm for the hygiene hypothesis. And the hygiene hypothesis makes the observation that societies where the children are still getting their typical infections, measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, a lot of rotavirus infections as, you know, babies and toddlers, that and that they probably also have parasites in them. These societies, as adults, have much less autoimmunity. And the presumption is that there is some important messaging that happens between these early childhood infections that we get from bacteria, viruses, and parasites that speak to our immune cells that may help regulate a healthy immune response so later in life there's less autoimmunity. That's a very important hypothesis. Again, gaining a lot of traction. So it raises the question that I think we are conducting an experiment, unintended, that by removing these infections because of antibiotics, because of vaccinations, we may be altering the maturation process of our immune cells and increasing the risk of autoimmunity, perhaps. It may just be one factor in addition to the nutrient deficiencies and the toxins. We have some other issues that I have concerns about. The vaccines are most effective when we use a live agent. But when you use a live agent, there'll be some individuals whose immune functions are so compromised that that live vaccine could kill them or seriously harm them. So science has, in the interest of not creating harm, now used a killed infectious agent. But our bodies know it's dead. We don't really mount much of an immune response. So again, scientists wanting to help decided that we have to give something that's irritating to the immune system to get it to react to this dead infecting agent. And so these irritating compounds are generally fairly toxic compounds. We usually had used some mercury components. Now there's some aluminum components. But whatever components we use will have some toxic effects. Our vaccines are studied in their clinical trials one at a time or in a small number of vaccines at a time. But when they're scheduled, there are many more vaccines clumped together. And I don't know that we've had studies that look at these adjuvants that are added to a killed vaccine that have really identified how much adjuvant is safe in a single day or is safe in a lifetime. You know, I think those are unresolved questions. Then another factor that I worry about, and I'll confess, I may be incorrect in my understanding here, but it's my recollection during medical school that I had read the government decided that vaccines had made such good public health policy that they would indemnify the vaccine makers from liability because of the public health benefits, and that we needed to have the vaccines produced so they create more financial incentives to decrease the financial risk for vaccine production. The unintended consequences of that is the development of vaccines that have less immediate public health benefit in terms of mortality. As we start creating vaccines for diseases that are not fatal but are inconvenient, which, again, raises concerns because most of these vaccine studies are short-term, immediate safety. We don't have any vaccine studies that look over the lifespan of the organism, that is, the lifespan of the human. So I think they're unknowns. There certainly are public health benefits I will not disagree with, but I think there are these public health risks that have not been adequately measured and quantified, related to the hygiene hypothesis, related to the adjuvant question, and then related to why are we creating vaccines for conditions that are not fatal. I am profoundly grateful to have my life back, and it's really transformed me. Obviously, it's transformed how I think about medicine. It's transformed how I practice medicine and how I do research. I see so many other people getting their lives back. I'm trying to take that message further and further. I'm incredibly optimistic because I see more and more medical colleagues and other people, ordinary people, experiencing these health transformations, writing, blogging, writing books. And because of the internet and the social media, this is getting more and more and more attention. The Institute for Functional Medicine is getting more and more attention. More medical schools and entities are embracing these concepts. I will be going to speak to Cigna Health Insurance in July about these concepts. So I think the public will learn from social media. I think the business models will begin to pay attention. And I think the pharmaceutical industries, they will be clever. They will respond. I'm not sure how they'll respond, if they will resist or if they will quickly adapt. But as long as we have the internet and publications so people can communicate one with another, this movement will continue to grow. I am wildly optimistic. Remember, I thought I was going to be demented and bedridden. And instead, I'm riding my bike. In fact, last week, you know, so 6 years ago, my kids accompanied me on my first bike ride around the block. Last week, my kids accompanied me on my first jog around the neighborhood. We went 0.9 miles. Wonderful. And what will I be doing next year? I'm not sure. Everything is possible. Everything is possible. The public will learn, and I think it will just continue to grow, that they'll learn that it's all about the food we eat, the food quality that we eat, whether or not we can reduce our exposures to toxins, to begin to move our bodies. I am immensely, immensely optimistic. As long as we have the social media and people can talk to each other. Because as we recover, we tell our friends, we tell our coworkers. I have physicians who are calling, actually from around the world, who want to come to my clinic to watch how I run the clinic. And, you know, I have other faculty from the university and other partners from the VA who come to my clinic to watch what we do. That's just 6 years. Change is happening. People are noticing.
My children are 7 and 10. Mary is in the first grade. Olivia is in the fifth grade, and she's graduating this year. Mary was born very tiny. She had allergic reactions to milk. She couldn't absorb. She was losing weight. We tried some specialized formulas for her, and the only one that her body could tolerate was Neocate, which is an amino acid-based formula. We thought that we were out of the woods when the mucus and blood started to subside in her stool. And then once I started to feed Mary food, she started with allergic reactions to every kind of food that I put into her system. She is highly allergic to any preservatives, unnatural substances, and artificial ingredients. When she was newborn, a couple of weeks old, she received the DPT. From that DPT, she started to, that's when we thought we were out of the woods with the milk allergy. She was completely intoxicated with thrush, crying unconsolably. She had rashes on her rectum, her vagina, the Hep B is very important, and that is the first shot that children get from the hospital. And I feel that that Hep B shot caused this situation with Mary coming home from the hospital, not absorbing and not being able to nurse with thrush and these other issues. A couple of weeks later, after she was treated, she had the DPT. We went right back to the same situation where she was completely intoxicated and not able to drink her formula and having other issues with rashes and blood and mucus in her stool. After we healed her from that situation on medication to get rid of the thrush, she was okay for a while until she got the next DPT shot. The next DPT shot caused more intoxication on the higher level than the first time. And then we started with rashes around her mouth, around her eyes, up her back, again, a diarrhea and vaginal redness and infections. The doctor was sending me to specialists to see what was wrong because he couldn't diagnose her. And every blood test that he took was unknown. Every time it was unknown, unknown. Fevers, unknown. Why? Why is she having this problem? Unknown. I went to a pulmonologist, and because Mary couldn't breathe at this point, and she was producing asthma. So the pulmonologist said that Mary had RSV. Mary did not have RSV. It was a misdiagnosis, but they put her on Pulmicort, Xopenex, other medications to open her airways. Whenever I would give her this medication, it would open her airways. It would cause other issues. We would now feed her cereal or whatever, apple sauce, whatever it was that an infant would get, and Mary would close and completely intoxicated again. She had mucus that was so thick in her nose that she couldn't breathe. I had to order a professional suction to hook up to a portable vacuum cleaner to suck the mucus out of her nose so that she can breathe. Then I would feed her again and she would get completely intoxicated. All of this is because of the vaccinations, because of the ingredients in the vaccinations that caused the intoxication. My daughter now has these severe allergic reactions to everything that we would give her. I would feel inside that I wasn't doing the right thing. I was doing what normal American people would do, because when you have a child, they say that this is what you're supposed to. This is the norm to vaccinate. I wasn't fully in understanding at the time on what I was doing, but as a mom, you have an instinct. And every time we did these vaccinations, my daughter would get completely intoxicated and she would get sick. And it would cost her months of her life and mine to get her well. Every time she got another vaccination, and the next one after these DPTs was the Comvax. That was the icing on the cake for her. The fevers, the uncontrollable crying, unconsolable crying that happened for hours on end. The rashes, again, the intoxication with yeast, not being able to eat, not gaining weight, not growing. We were right back to square one. Now she has a double ear infection. This is an infant. Why is an infant getting a double ear infection? More doctors, more specialists. Nobody can pinpoint what's wrong. But inside, I knew what was happening. And every time that I know now, I shouldn't say I knew then, because I was still searching for the answer from the doctors. When the medical professionals did not know what to do and didn't have an answer for me, that was when I had to just stop and look at the whole picture. After Mary had that Comvax and she had the double ear infection, my doctor recommended for her to have an antibiotic. The first time I tried to give her the antibiotic, she projectile vomited in seconds. I didn't realize that this was an allergic reaction at the time. It didn't hit me. And when I called the doctor and told him that she projectile vomited, I said, this is vile. tasting medicine, maybe that's why. So maybe my words didn't make him think that this was an allergic reaction as well. And he said, well, you have to get this antibiotic in her because this is the only way to heal her ear infection. It's really bad. So I had it filled, and I was, again, my motherly instinct was that this isn't good. I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't feel that it was the right thing. But again, the doctor said that this is what I needed to do, and she was very ill at the time. So I went against my conscience. I went against my instinct as a mom. I said a prayer, and I inserted the suppository. Within 20 seconds, Mary went into anaphylactic shock. She was projectile vomiting. She had diarrhea pouring out of her rectum. Her eyes rolled behind her head. She lost her color. It was complete anaphylactic shock. I screamed for the Lord to help me, because save my baby in the name of Jesus, because I could not do this on my own. And Mary came back to me in seconds. And the calmness and the peace that was over her face and over her body and the way she looked at me. So from that minute on, there was no more medicine, no more doctors. I chose to treat my daughter holistically and all natural. And we have not did medicine ever since Mary has been 10 months old. And that's how I choose now to heal my children. Holistically, to me, is with natural foods, which is organic, no GMOs, nothing from a box. I make my own food. Our vegetables are organically grown and not treated with any pesticides, antibiotics, because Mary is anaphylactic to antibiotic and she cannot handle the preservatives that are put into our food. My daughter will get sick. So I have to be very careful what I choose to feed her. And also with minerals, we treat our bodies with natural minerals when we're sick, which is vitamin C, vitamin D, magnesium, calcium, if needed. It depends on what's wrong, on how I choose and what I choose to aid the healing in whatever sickness that we're dealing with. I applied for a religious exemption in 2010 when Mary started preschool. I was religiously exempt from these vaccinations in 2009 from my pediatrician's office already, and I chose to put her in a preschool and gave a religious exemption, and everything seemed to be fine. I didn't have a problem in the beginning, but then when Mary went to kindergarten, for some reason my religious exemption was lost, wasn't found. It wasn't sent to the school in her file as it should have been. And 2012, Mary took a turn for the worst at a very small scale with her health. She just, I guess her immune system was compromised, and we found out that she had an overactive immune system, and that now that we started to do some testing to see what the problem was from the past of blood work, we realized where we stood medically. I was offered a medical exemption. I didn't apply it to the Board of Education because I felt it was unnecessary. I already had a religious exemption in place since 2010, and they knew this in the school because I interviewed them before I chose to put Mary in the school. How this happened to me, I don't know. I think it was a clerical error, and nobody wanted to admit their mistakes, but in the end, I am going through this. My daughter was tortured from this experience. She was traumatized and never was able to finish her kindergarten year with her friends from preschool. But we got through it as a family, and it's okay, and she knows that it's okay now. We are going forward with this lawsuit with the Board of Education and the Department of Health because my daughter very well qualifies for this religious exemption. Our family does. We deserve it. And we don't deserve to have people turn their backs on us because this is our choice of living and how we want to care for our family. It's our choice. My daughter's medical condition, which is very real, and there are other children who have these medical issues and worse off than Mary, and they should be respected, and they're not. They're ignored, and they're thrown to the side. They need to respect the fact that a doctor who we trust, our family doctor, gives an opinion. And this is the only person who I will trust with my daughter's health. I've had misdiagnosis before. Conventional medicine doesn't work for our family. And I just feel that our choices as parents should be respected. In the beginning, I felt I didn't know really it was going to escalate to this. I was just being honest and being truthful. And I, like I said, in the beginning, I felt that maybe it was a mistake, but now I realize that it isn't. And I wasn't aware of this whole vaccine frenzy, and I wasn't aware of anything that was going on here with this situation, and I didn't know that children could not go to school without being vaccinated. Well, I know now that that's a lie. I met my lawyer. I felt I was actually introduced to her because I was reaching out to everyone on what do I do? How do I do this? I was being manipulated. I felt that I was being taken advantage of. So I hired my lawyer, Patty Finn, and she helped me in guiding me through this process that I'm being forced through. I feel that I need to protect my own child for her rights and for our rights as parents, and also for other parents who are in the same situation, because as I'm going through this journey, I have parents reach out to me and call me crying that they are forced to vaccinate their children because there will be consequences that they are facing as far as services for their children, or parents that are poor, people that have no money and they can't feed their kids and they're on food stamps and they have to vaccinate their children in order to continue food stamps, in order to feed their children. They already know that maybe their child has a problem mentally or physically, but yet, and they feel in their gut and in their conscience that this is not right, and they cry. And they're forced because they're afraid that their children will get taken away. And they are threatened with this. And I was unaware of this. I didn't know that a child could actually be taken away from their parents because the parent chooses not to vaccinate. I feel that that is a disgrace. And if a parent is feeling that their child could be harmed, or if it is against their religion or what they believe is best for their child, who could force someone to do anything when it comes to their own body? It's a disgrace. So we have to go forward. And there's a law that's been in place for 105 maybe years that is outdated, makes no sense, and our children are suffering because of this law that needs to be changed. And maybe, just maybe, we can make the difference. Maybe we were put here. Maybe this is our purpose. I don't know what our purpose is and why I'm put in this place and why I'm in this position. But I can't turn my back. And I feel that I need to go forward because it just feels right for me, for my family, and for others. As far as religion, the immunizations weren't for me because of the ingredients, the toxic ingredients, the preservatives, the unnatural substances. And then when I started to research them more and more, the aborted fetus cells were definitely shocking. There are pig and bovine and monkey tissue and a lot of unnatural substances that definitely affect a lot of religions, not just mine. I met a woman who is, she's Muslim. She hardly speaks English, and she didn't know that the there was pig and these ingredients of the tissue of animal in the vaccinations. When we had a conversation about her child, she was confiding into me when I explained to her, do you know what's in the vaccinations? She fell to the floor crying. I had to pick her up off the floor and console her and tell her that she will be forgiven, that she will be forgiven. I felt terrible that parents don't know what ingredients are in these vaccinations. And if you feel that this is okay for you, and you know what's in them as far as formaldehyde, mercury, the preservatives alone, the gluten, the peanut oil, these things that should not be injected into a bloodstream. But as far as religion, the bovine and the tissue from animals and the, again, aborted fetus cells, it is restricted. We should not be doing this. We are not for and do not put these things into our bodies.
Patty, can you give me a little explanation of what your practice is like? What kind of things you focus on?
Sure. The bulk of my practice involves vaccinations. I work with parents who don't want to vaccinate their children and the vaccine injured. That's primarily all we've done. Because we're in New York, the work that we're doing is really changing the law. We're really on the frontier. New York is a very pro-pharma state, and it's nearly impossible to get out of a vaccine and go to school.
Patty, if a family already has a child who suffered vaccine damage, and then therefore the parents assume that, well, our next children that we're going to have might have the same types of susceptibilities to the vaccination, can those parents then refuse vaccination for their next child or children and still send them to public school?
Well, it does depend on the state. Most states will give you religious or medical exemptions, except for West Virginia and Mississippi. In those states, it's only medical. So if you're in a state that allows for a philosophical exemption, whatever your reason is, you can opt out. But if you're in a state primarily on the East Coast that will not allow philosophical, you would have a problem. The fact that a sibling has been injured or that there may be a genetic predisposition is insufficient under certain state laws. So no, that is not a good enough reason.
Wow. I mean, because I think even, you know, because look at the Brusewitz case and Hannah Poehling, there, at least with Hannah Poehling, I mean, there's some admission that there's mitochondrial disease, that there might be some underlying predisposition for some children, right? So you would think, based on that, that the states would be reasonable and say, well, okay, this family, their first child suffered, they have some underlying susceptibility, so therefore, you know, the parents aren't going to vaccinate the next child. And I mean, what can they do? What are the options?
Well, you know, some states, it's easy to opt out. Texas, for example, very easy to opt out. Florida, even New Jersey, pharma capital of the world. You want out, you're out. But states like New York, which, you know, is clearly a battleground state, you cannot opt out. And even if your doctor said or gave you an exemption that said, you know, a sibling has had an issue with vaccines, that sanguine relationship is not good enough. You actually have to have an adverse event. So you have to have had a shot and been injured in order to get a medical exemption. The other option that's recognized is religion. And all states except West Virginia and Mississippi recognize religion. And that too is very problematic because people are interviewed. And if you're interviewed and someone doesn't believe you or they're not knowledgeable on the law and what the law allows, you can very easily be denied an exemption. So the bulk of the litigation that we do, we definitely do vaccine injuries and we handle those, but The focus of my work has been on an individual's right to simply refuse. And right now, the law is that you cannot opt out in some states.
Okay, so that's really confusing. I mean, I'm a physician, and I certainly know that legally vaccines are classified as unavoidably unsafe, and they come with a risk, and there's a table of injuries that is listed in the compensation program. So you're telling me that for the most part, most states in this country say that you don't have a choice for a medical procedure?
It does depend on the state law that narrows it, but yes, that is the case. 100 years ago, there was a case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts, and in that case, the courts held that under a police power, the government can force you to vaccinate. And that's what we're facing right now. You know, New York is a little different, but it is one of the more troubling states, but it does occur throughout the United States that your rights to refuse are overridden by this 1905 case, Jacobson versus Massachusetts. So that's what we're trying to knock out, Jacobson.
Well, but even in that case, wasn't that in the event of an epidemic and you had you could opt out with a fine, a $5 fine?
Yes, and unfortunately, it's obvious that court had no idea what the kids today are being faced with in terms of vaccines. That was one shot during a so-called outbreak over 100 years ago. The law in that case is now applied to every child in, say, in New York City going to school, has to get a flu shot, has to get 77 doses of diseases by the age of 14 in order to go to school. And it's very, very hard to opt out. Medical is nearly impossible. If you do get a medical exemption, if you do get a doctor to give you a reason, it has to be a very specific reason, and it has to have a timing on it. As a medical doctor, you could not give someone a medical exemption that says this child can't get any shots because their brother was injured. Absolutely not acceptable. You could get an exemption, say that this child has an egg allergy and can't get one shot, or this child, due to some illness, needs another 12 months before they complete it. But to get a blanket medical is impossible. The only type of blanket that exists is religion, and religion bumps up against Jacobson. So that's where we're at right now. And we're going to trial in June on that. We're very, very excited because after 10 years of scrapping in federal courts, I finally have an opportunity to challenge the constitutionality and the safety of the Childhood Immunization Program. No court has really looked at this particular issue the way we're addressing it since Jacobson 100 years ago. And it's our goal to get the court to recognize an individual has a right to refuse. What's troubling you about my answers is it just seems unnatural. How could that be in the United States? What's bugging you is that it violates due process. You may not know that because you're not a lawyer, but that's the problem here. Why is it that an individual has to be forced to take a vaccine? You have a right of due process to refuse. You can't be forced to take a shot. And Congress has recognized vaccines do kill. People do die. We represent families where their children died from the shots. And in some states, like New York, the state government does not recognize that. You are mandated to take these shots. And that violates due process.
It leaves me speechless. I mean, it's you know, terrible. I'm a physician, so I understand a medical procedure should never be forced on anyone, and they should have a right to decide if they want to take that risk. And in the vaccination risk, of course, if something happens to them, they have nowhere to go. You know, It's amazing. It's just they've taken a law and they've run with it and to their advantage.
Well, they're bullies. You know, they terrorize everybody, the pharmaceutical interests. And some of the doctors that are very involved in profiting from vaccines, and they go after people like me and others that are out there trying to stop it. But fortunately, through social media and other ways, like movies like this, that we've had an opportunity to garner together. And now it's not one voice. It's not me alone in the courtroom. It's me and the 5,000 angry mothers that I represent. And you know, we're an educated group. We're not quacky or, you know, this is serious. Our kids are getting sick. We have a right to refuse. We're educated, we're organized, and the law is on our side. So in that way, after a long, long time and a very hard road, I am super happy that in June of 2014 in Brooklyn, there is a judge that is going to hear our argument as to why a little girl named Mary Check in Queens has a substantive due process right to refuse the shot. And that hasn't happened in a long, long time.
How long?
100 years.
That's a long time.
Yes. I mean, we've made some attempts to litigate it based on religion, but this is a broader question. I've really raised the issue of due process with the court, because not everybody has a religious belief contrary to vaccinating. Of course. And I would not recommend that you feign that you do. You know, if you live in a state that doesn't allow for a religious exemption, I would not recommend that you submit you do. You have to try to change the law. You can homeschool, you go to another state, you know, there are alternatives. But if you are in a place where, you know, the law is not in your favor, your job is to change the law.
So I know from reading that you were harassed personally for the work that you're doing as a lawyer.
Yes.
And can you talk about that at all?
Oh, be happy to. It was when I didn't talk about it that the pressure was unbelievable, because I was afraid. And it was finally when the community came to my aid, and of course, Dr. Wakefield and the supporters that he had, when they turned to me and helped me, and I went public with this story. So no, I don't mind talking about it at all. But there were a lot of pharma interests trying to stop me, discredit my work. We were being cyber attacked, hacked, followed, you know.
Followed?
Followed. Illegal surveillance. I mean, endless.
Illegal surveillance.
Yes. And in fact, I even knew about some of the illegal surveillance, and it was so out of control, I couldn't stop it. And since we were doing nothing wrong, you know, I just let it continue. But ultimately, a demand was made upon me for the names of the children that I represent who are not immunized. And I refused.
Isn't that a violation of, you know, the lawyer-client relationship?
Yes, and it's a violation of HIPAA, and it violates my client's First, Ninth, and 14th Amendment rights. I mean, people refuse vaccines, you know, for other than religious reasons. You talked about medical reasons, right? Well, Roe v. Wade. In Roe v. Wade, the court recognized an individual's right to either accept or refuse medical treatment. Cruzan, another important case, an inmate case, your right to refuse medical. My clients clearly were asserting these rights, these recognized rights, and I wasn't going to give up their names. And they, you know, I got into a lot of trouble.
What happened?
Well, I'm still in trouble now, but I mean, I'm not overly concerned about it, because it's going through its process and it's dying a slow death. But I think had the community not surrounded me and embraced me, I may have, you know, collapsed myself. But I was strengthened by the love of the people out there. And it sort of, I looked at it and it was fear. You know, they were trying to scare me, and they got my back to the wall, and that was it. And I came back swinging, me and 5,000 other mothers.
Amazing.
And, yeah, it was amazing.
I mean, to follow you, that's really frightening, to
it
be
was.
Followed. How did you feel?
I was very afraid. And, you know, I'm from New York. You know, we're kind of tough guys. And I was afraid for a long time. And then when I swung back, it was like a glass jaw. I realized a lot of it was delusional, and they were, you know, just trying to scare me. And there was nothing there when I really looked at it. And then I had the strength to continue. And now we have a trial on the constitutionality and safety of the vaccine program. If I had given in 2 years ago when all that happened, I wouldn't be going to trial in 4 months to protect the rights of individuals to opt out of vaccines. And that was the plan, to stop me.
5,000 mothers.
Well, it's actually even more than that. But I have in my firm, I represent close to 5,000 parents and children. And when they asked for the names of the kids that I represented, you know, I informed my clientele, and you know, they rallied, and then the internet community rallied behind me. So it was actually hundreds of thousands of people.
Hundreds of thousands of
yes.
people supporting you.
And everyone, every other mother and parent involved here. You don't mess with a mama bear's cubs. I don't care who you are. I litigate in Brooklyn, lower Manhattan. These are tough places. I wouldn't want to mess with an angry mother who's protecting her child any day of the week. And so in many ways, they ended up helping us, as scary as it was.
Because it really coalesced everyone together.
It was amazing.
So you've got a lot of support behind
mm-hmm.
you.
Yes.
That's wonderful. So let me ask you something. This judge who's willing to take this on in Brooklyn, how do we know pharma is not going to somehow threaten this judge and whoever's above the judge? Is this guy elected into his position? Is it an appointment? You know, because this is how pharma works, right? I mean,
yes.
Are you concerned about
no.
that?
No, not at all. I know that the government is dysfunctional and it fails a lot, but the courts do work. They are sometimes hard to navigate and get through, and it's taken me a long time, but they work and they are honest. And I don't believe that only the wealthy get justice. I don't believe that at all. I believe scrappers get justice if they can hang on long enough. And, you know, we've fought and we're in there. So I'm very happy and I'm thrilled. I couldn't have asked for a better judge to review this. He's a brilliant, educated, honest man. And whether I get a good decision or not, I've never once questioned the integrity of any of the judges. And I've had some harsh rulings and adverse outcomes, but they're synthesizing. We're narrowing. We're getting right to the issue, and I finally am getting now to someone to take a look at the due process problem here. You know, this is the United States. We don't experiment on children. I don't care if my pleading was defective or I didn't use the right blue back or I got there on the wrong day. It's ridiculous. You know, this is the United States. We do not experiment on children. And somebody's got to figure this out. I mean, I can't be the only one that, you know, in the courts anyway. And obviously Judge Kuntz, who's, you know, far more experienced than I am, you know, he's recognized that and he's given us the opportunity. So I couldn't be happier.
Do you feel that you're still being harassed? I mean, is...
No.
No, so you're not afraid and you don't feel... I mean, I just know from looking at old cases like the Vioxx case or the Avandia case, I know there was an internal memo with Merck on, you know, doctors that needed to be neutralized. So I'm assuming there's lawyers that need to be neutralized. You know, that is overwhelming. And I think that there's a lot of people who maybe recognize what you recognize but are afraid to come forward.
You know, I was afraid until I'm a very faithful person and I believe in God and for whatever reason, I'm on this path, and I'm not the only one that this has happened to. We set the standard here for human rights, and there's no guarantee in the United States that your rights aren't going to be burdened. You know, people's rights are burdened all the time. What we're guaranteed is redress and fairness, and that's been denied for a long, long time. But your rights can be burdened. You know, your religious beliefs can be burdened, and they are. The courts have to balance it. And when it comes to vaccines, what they do is they say, okay, well, I have a religious belief that's contrary to vaccinating. And then the courts have to look at, well, is the public health being served by the vaccines sufficient to mandate someone to take a treatment that could kill them? That's where you find it unusual, and anybody would. And that is a due process issue. So in my mind, I see little Mary Check. Mary is our plaintiff, and she's a little girl from Staten Island. And her doctor said she cannot get the vaccines, but the city of New York said, sorry, we will not recognize your doctor's recommendation. Her mother, devout Catholic, I cannot vaccinate the child contrary to my religious beliefs. City of New York said, sorry, you got to take the shots. So in my mind, here's Mary sitting on the little doctor's table, and they're coming at her with the needle. And they get right to her, up goes the screen, bells and whistles go off. Mary has a due process right to refuse. And that's what the court will address on June 30th. It's unprecedented. And it's a gift. It is an absolute gift.
I mean, this is a human rights issue, ultimately.
A totally human rights issue.
Because it's a risk. Just so you know, I mean, there's so many people who say vaccines are safe. They're safe for everyone. There's no risk. There's so many vocal proponents in the industry that say vaccines are absolutely safe that people who say that they're not safe are crazy.
Yeah, we get that a lot, too. But, you know, Congress has recognized that vaccines are not safe. And that's why we have a compensation program for people that are injured. Since 1986, $2.8 billion has been awarded. We know the shots are not safe. And quite frankly, the manipulation of disease in general is a terribly dangerous practice. These shots are coming from China. They're being made. Who knows who's transporting them? Are they being appropriately refrigerated? You know, you can't even get milk from New Jersey in the hot weather into Manhattan. That's not spoiled. You know, you're taking vaccines coming from secret labs in Europe, unidentified places. It's so weird. It's behavior that is not tolerated in the United States. I'm not going to give my baby some shot from a secret lab. It's crazy.
It is crazy, but it is tolerated in the United States.
Well, I mean, people are afraid. It's all right. Fear, you know, and pharmaceutical marketing is pure fear. Profit driven, the shots, the money to the doctors for getting you into the well visits. You know, you have a new baby, you got to bring it to the doctor every 2 weeks. Why? It's to get a vaccine. And they just, it's such a profit driven industry. It's disgusting. In the United States, for example, when children are born, the minute they're born, they're given a hepatitis vaccine. And that makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. Why would anybody want to inject a perfectly healthy baby with hepatitis or any of these other shots? We don't know where they come from. You don't know what they're made of. You know, really, in religion, when you think about it, there's a lot of prohibitions in many, many, many faiths about engaging in things that are unclean, defiling the blood with impure substances. Shots, as we know, have pig cells in them, bovine cells, some really horrible ingredients, and then you're being forced to inject them into a new baby. It's ridiculous. And I think when more and more mothers realize, and again, you know, the most formidable opponent is an angry mother, you know, trying to protect her kid. I would not want to cross a mother. I would take 10 lawyers in Lower Manhattan before one angry mother who doesn't want a shot any day of the week. And that has been the energy and the impetus that has moved us forward. Thank God. I'm happy.
Well, there you have it. What an amazing bonus day. So much rich information. By now, after 10 days, 10 episodes of Vaccines Revealed, an unprecedented thing in the history of the vaccine movement, you can now see how many very articulate, very brilliant, very well-credentialed people can speak to this vaccine issue in a way that is so compelling, so enlightening, and in some ways very infuriating when we see that the government wants to mandate that people must have these vaccines and how atrocious the concept of that is and how offensive it is to parental rights and personal liberties. You can start to see that this information is critical, must get out to the masses, and I am so appreciative that you were here to witness it. I want to encourage you to acquire this information, to join us in this movement, to pick either the silver or the gold package, whichever one suits you best, that this information must be known, must be owned, and must be disseminated. This can't be kept a secret. Don't miss out on the 50% discount. There's still time to get that. Just choose the silver or gold package. You'll get the 50% discount, and you'll have this information to review and share over and over again. On a very personal note, it has been a privilege to take this journey with you. There's very few things that matter on a level that can alter generations and alter the destiny of humanity. I think the information that we had covered over the course of Vaccines Revealed is of that level. Let's keep the spirit strong. Let us not forget what has gone on in the world, and let us be a part of the solution and not the problem. Thank you for taking this journey in Vaccines Revealed.